Good morning.
Good morning.
Or almost afternoon for you.
11:30.
Yeah.
Still technically morning.
So how are you doing?
Pretty good. It's been a while.
Yeah.
Almost a month, I guess.
Even though we just released the episode last week.
Yeah, it even fooled me. Thought made me feel like we talked more recently.
Yeah. Well, this is Geek Brunch Retrocast Episode 6. I am Mike, and I'm here with.
Chris, I'm
Ta-da!
Chris.
And we're back for the holiday.
First episode of 2013.
Yeah. I got some feedback. I thought I'd start with that.
Cool.
This is from S Steve Zinodas, or is, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, even though I talk to him a lot on the interwebs. He left some feedback on I think it was the last episode, but he said he would definitely suggest doing Retrocast that talks about the phenomenon of Saturday morning cartoons. And then he said he would absolutely love to come on and talk about those cartoons as well as any Bronze Age books as well. He's into his 40s, so he's more in my age. Well, we didn't have no VCR. We couldn't record no cartoons. And he said he loves the show. He says either way, keep doing what you're doing and let the show run as long as you want. He loves the long play times. And then he said he'd also like us to cover some treasury editions if we could, like Superman versus Ali or Spider-Man versus Superman. Those
Oh,
big
yeah.
oversized books. I know the latest back issue, well, maybe it's not the latest, but the one prior to the latest has a is a treasury edition size. Maybe we could talk about that. Do you get back issue?
I haven't been consistent in ordering it every month. I'm not sure if I have that one coming or not. If not, I can grab it. The only reason I don't order it every time is I have several here that I haven't gotten to reading, so
Right.
since they're pretty easy to get. So sometimes I'll put it in my DCBS order, and sometimes if I miss one and I'm in a phase of reading them, I'll grab it from directly from tomorrow's, but
And then he was saying we should talk about the Kiss comic book. You know how they use real Kiss blood in the ink?
Oh yeah.
I heard that that made the it didn't make the comic book though. I heard I don't know if I just heard this as a rumor, but I heard that it went into some magazine like People Magazine or something instead of the comic book.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. I remember hearing vaguely about that, but I don't know off the top of my head.
And the death of Robin, Rock versus Disco, Stan Lee's origin of the Marvel Comics, and Planet of the Apes. So yeah, we could talk about some of those things.
Yeah, he is
The
involved
host.
in the podcast as well, right?
Yeah, Altered Egos, where the E is a three.
Right. The Ian altered.
Yeah.
And he goes by Noob, I believe, right?
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, he got in touch with me as well, and he had a lot of good suggestions. He told me that he sent a bunch to you, and one other one was he brought up the various humor mags that have relationship to comic books, like Mad Magazine and stuff, which is also a good suggestion. So definitely appreciate the feedback and the suggestions, because like I told him, sometimes it's I had a bunch of ideas for our middle segment topics at one point, but I've been kind of dry lately thinking of stuff. And just, I mean, there's so much stuff that we could talk about, and it's good to know, especially what people are the people that are listening, what they're interested in hearing about too.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's cool. I always appreciate hearing from people that are listening.
Yeah, it's good to get feedback.
Yeah, definitely. So this was your first week back to work, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was pretty painful.
Yeah. It wasn't my first week back, but it was my first 5-day week in a while. And man, it seems so long. I can't believe it's a normal thing to do.
Yeah. It was for me, it was like 2-week break, but man, it went so fast. That first week just went fast. And then when I was decompressing the second week, man, time just flew.
Yeah.
And it flies during the work week too. It's just doing stuff that I'd rather be reading comics.
Yeah, time is funny like that. It always goes by fast when you're having fun. It's true. You know, and then sometimes when you're at work, it can drag.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you tend to be pretty busy all the time at work. So
yeah, my blood pressure's usually up. It's like getting bombarded.
Yeah. It's hard to remain calm when there's a lot of stress and pressure.
Yeah, so far I've done good, though.
That's good.
It's my New Year's resolution. I'm trying to remain calm under pressure.
Yeah, you gotta, like, harness the power of Shang-Chi.
That's right.
Or, what's Iron Fist's,
Kunlun?
Kunlun or something Kunlun. Like that, yeah. Get the inner peace going.
Yep.
So, what did you want to start out with this week?
I thought we could end with the Kirby because we're finishing off the first omnibus.
Yeah, sounds like a good idea.
And that was very interesting stuff. Don Rickles makes an appearance. What the fuck is this?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we'll get to that.
I read a couple of things, and there's one that I want to talk about that man, it just barely misses the cutoff. But I was going through a box, and for some reason, usually when I get back issues, the first thing I do is I log it in my database so I don't rebuy any issues.
Yeah.
Well, I ran across a box that I never cataloged. Uh-huh. And it had various stuff in it, like Atari Force and some old Superboy, The Witching, Superman Families, US1, all kinds of weird shit. But I ran across this Vertigo series, and man, I just don't remember buying it or but it was really interesting. It was called The Witching. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it ties into Lucifer or what, because I know Lucifer was a Vertigo series I didn't read either. But he makes an appearance, and it's just so bizarre because it has like flash forwards, flashbacks, futuristic things. And I really don't know where it's going, but it's so damn interesting. But there's this one witch. At least she was born on when the moon was a full moon and all that stuff. And she's being worshipped by some people on another planet. And she's like the one that's dialoguing the story. And then there's this other girl who's like a teenage girl. Like, I think they're high school, and she's with this football quarterback or receiver. And she won't sleep with him. He's trying to get her into bed and all, but he doesn't seem like a bad guy or anything, but she's the second girl. And then the third girl is a member of, or she opens up for the Osiris band, which is like a goth band. And, she's the third witch, I guess, or going to be the third witch, but it all ties it in. And then it gives you flashbacks of their parents and stuff like that, and how these three witches are going to unite. But it's got a very sci-fi and magical twist to it, which I really liked. And I don't have the whole series, so after we finish podcasting, I'm going to read what I have And if I like the rest of it, I'm just going to order my comic shop, because I don't want to lose what I have. Like, I'll forget about it, and I want to finish the storyline if it's good.
Yeah, if you wait too long.
And it was 2004 that it came out, and the writer was Jonathan Vankin, which I've never ever heard of. And the art was by Leigh Gallagher.
It looks like it ran for 10 issues.
Yeah, and I only have
Altogether.
five. I think what happened is I bought these at a con, like just I think I was at like the Denver con or one of those cons, and I just was thumbing through some books that I knew I didn't have because I didn't have my list of back issues to fill. So I was like, I don't have this. I know I don't have this, and they had five of these, The Witching, and I picked them up, and it's very interesting. I liked it a lot. Like, you know what, a first issue just grabs you that you want to go read the rest. That's a good thing.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, it looks like I hadn't heard of Jonathan Vankin either. It looks like he's written some comics. He's also he worked at he was a senior editor at Vertigo up until about a couple years ago. He also wrote Brightest Day Aftermath, The Search for Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
Couple graphic novels, but he's so we at least according to Wikipedia is known for his books Conspiracies, Covers Up and Crimes, and 50 Greatest or the World's Greatest Conspiracies and stuff like that, so
The other thing that was interesting is the editor on this was Shelley Bond, and I think she's the Vertigo editor now. I think she took over for Karen Berger.
oh yeah, that sounds right.
So that was a good issue. This was just misses the deadline by 1 year, but what the hell? It's 2004.
Yeah. I'll let it slide this time. Yeah, it's that's that can be fun when you find comics that I mean, one thing about having everything cataloged, it does take some of the mystery of discovery out of your collection. You know, you I mean, obviously you want to know what's there and stuff, but and so there's been a few times where I've come across something I didn't remember that I had like that, but I know one time I took a break from buying new comics. The last couple orders I got in, I didn't get around to reading them, so when I went back, flipping through the stack of stuff that I had sitting there, when I've read stuff, usually the cover gets, stuck in my brain. So I'm flipping through the pile and it's a lot of stuff that I didn't remember and it's like, oh, cool, I have this. But
Yeah, this was a cool find. I don't even remember buying it. And the art I liked a lot. I really liked the art, so it was good.
cool. Yeah, I remember that coming out, but I never.
Just was kind of disturbed. Like, this one girl takes that her boyfriend who wants to have sex with her on a ride in her nice car, 'cause I guess her father's really, really rich. And her father's out of town, and she ends up like just wrecking the car, and it looks like she might have killed that guy, but he never like seemed like he was a bad guy. Like, they didn't show him doing anything bad.
It looks like it was supposed to be an ongoing, so if you do end up reading the whole 10 issues, I'm curious as if if they were able to wrap up things in the last issue or not.
Yeah. Like, I just finished Dominic Laveau. I know that's not an old one, but that was one where I think it was going to be an ongoing, and they just shoved it all. They, like, crammed 3 issues into the last issue, you know what I mean? And it was like,
Yeah.
what? It's like, this doesn't even seem like it flows well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like a catch-22. You want things to be resolved, but if there was a lot of threads, a lot of plot elements that they had to wrap up, it can not make for the greatest story.
Yeah.
You know? I when that came out, that four pack that DCBS had the deal, you could get all four number ones from Vertigo. So I did read that number one, and I wasn't too crazy about it, so I never read any of the other issues.
Yeah, it started off slow, and then the middle part of it was so damn good, and then it ended real poorly. So I don't know, like, if I could recommend it. I would recommend it if you like Coen art, but other than that, or if you like voodoo a lot, like Haiti and New Orleans and that kind of stuff, you might be into it, but.
Yeah, I mean that stuff all sounds good to me. But for whatever reason, the first issue didn't really click with me.
Yeah, I think Michael liked it, but he felt the same way I did. He's like he didn't like the way it started. Like it read the first two issues and he could care less, and then he kept reading and then he really liked it. And his favorite issue was six, which was my favorite issue, and then or five, and then he thought it wrapped up really quick too.
Yeah. That's too bad sometimes. Maybe it was finding its feet, you know.
Yeah.
You can't, things don't get a chance sometimes if they don't catch on right away. But well, I picked up a whole bunch of stuff specifically to listen to or to check out over the course of time for the show. But I thought it would be, when I was growing up and into comics, I pretty much read all superhero stuff and mostly Marvel. So, a lot of the creator-owned and indie stuff that came out in the 80s, I'm not familiar with. I'm only aware of in name, basically. And even though now, nowadays, I like to read a lot of creative-owned stuff and whatnot. So, and a lot of the stuff, for the most part, can be found pretty cheap. It's not necessarily a reflection of the quality. So I got, the first couple issues of a lot of different stuff that I'll be trying over time and seeing if I want to, grab some other issues of different stuff.
Where did you procure them? Like online or at a shop or?
Online.
Okay.
I did an order from a place that had a lot of like 50-cent books and stuff. I do a lot of back issue shopping through ComicCollectorLive.com,
Ah.
which I find to be a pretty good place. It's almost all, just different shops. I mean, some of them are strictly online only. People who just have in their house or whatever have a collection of comics, or they buy, bulk lots and then split them up and sell them individual issues and stuff. But and then there's also LCSs that just are looking for an alternative revenue source and stuff. You can kind of, what's nice is you can search a title and you can see multiple shops at one time. So if there's a particular issue or something like that that you're looking for or a run, you can browse all the shops that are in Comic Collector Live at the same time.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, so it's pretty neat. And this, and a lot of the, and
Can you
a
look by
lot.
publisher and writer or creators, or is it just limited titles, or how's that work?
I don't think you can search. Yeah, I don't. Although there are hyperlinks and stuff like that, like on the, if you bring up the page for an individual issue.
Yeah.
So I think, I don't know if you could search straight up, but I think you could, bring up an issue that a creator worked on, and then click on the hyperlink for that creator. But one thing I like is that a lot of the shops have free shipping if you spend a certain amount. It's a good place to find stuff to try, and like I said, some shops have like 50-cent books or 75-cent books and stuff, and a lot of the stuff that I picked up, I just kind of did an order of a bunch of 50-cent or 75-cent comics, trying first few issues or so, of a lot of different stuff that indie stuff from the 80s that I'd, you know, heard of but never tried. So first one I was going to talk about today was pretty random. This is one actually I hadn't heard of going in and was just looking for, I guess, maybe one more book to throw in to get the shipping and stuff, and noticed it. It's Puma Blues.
I never heard of that one.
And I think I just noticed that it's published by Aardvark One International, David Sims' company. I guess that's probably where Cerebus all came through, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm imagining. This is by, it was $1.70 cover price, came out, let's see, in 86. What I have actually, it looks like, is the second printing. And this is by Stephen Murphy and Michael Zuli. So I knew absolutely nothing about this. I did look it up on Wikipedia, and you know, apparently that this had some decent acclaim at the time it was coming out from names like Alan Moore and such that were big in the 80s around this time with this kind of you know, the indie movement and stuff like that. It's black and white. It's post-apocalyptic, basically, though it takes place in what was then the future and now is the past. Kind of takes place around the turn of the century. Apparently, like, the artist, Michael Zuli, he's a big, he's known kind of for his, like, wildlife art and stuff. And it does, it sort of reminds me of, in some ways, you know, you guys were on the last episode of Geek Brunch, the regular one that you guys came out, Micah was talking about The Massive.
Yeah.
And it's, I wouldn't compare it directly, but one thing that did remind me of is, you know, in The Massive, you're pretty much following the crew of a ship, and you get some information about the status of the entire world through captions and through things that the characters hear and stuff. And, you know, this issue pretty much focuses on this one guy that is out in the wilderness, and that's where you get, you know, the wildlife art and stuff like that, that his surroundings, you know, he's pretty much in the forest. And you know, this first issue pretty much is kind of laying the groundwork. There's some pages that are really dense with captions, and it's like a narration of the main character. And then there are pages that just don't really have much dialogue or anything, just kind of gives you a sense of the atmosphere and, you know, the world that this character is living in. It hit me kind of middle of the road. I would give it like a 3 out of 5 sort of. You know, the art was good. Kind of has this like a sketchy quality to it. But at the same time, I mean, it wasn't, you know, I wasn't grabbed. Like I have to read the next issue to find out what happened. Cause it, like I said, really just, it really kind of introduces you to this predicament, the world that this character is living in, without really giving a strong sense of a particular threat or danger to kind of to grab you. It doesn't really end on a cliffhanger or anything. And in fact, it ends with panels that show the character digging into some old tapes that apparently were left behind by his father. He's going to dig into and watch and find out some more things about his father that he didn't know. But the middle of the column, there's like the page is like split into like 3 columns, and the middle one has all this text that gives, it's like says New York Times teletext, and it's all kind of information about stuff that's happening around the world. And I have to admit, I kind of skimmed it. Because it was just like a lot of, if they had kind of broken it up throughout the issue, it might have been a little bit better. But conceptually it's pretty cool. I wouldn't, like, if I saw these issues, for 50 cents or cheaper, I wouldn't stop to pick them up, maybe get around to them, but it's not going to be the first thing I track down as far as like some of the other stuff, or really like all the other stuff I read for this time around, I like better. But one thing I did think was funny about it was being that it was the 80s and is looking forward to the future that's, years that have already passed in the present. Some of the technology, like I said, is the tapes that his dad leaves behind are actual VCR tapes. And he gets like reports from his bosses or whatever on a printer that's a dot matrix printer. So it's like, it's typical when you look back at stuff that take place in the future, it's sometimes the technology doesn't totally line up, which is kind of, it's not, I wouldn't fault the book for that, but it's just kind of funny
Yeah, that
looking
is.
back.
Instead of doing a Jack Kirby machine like a mother box, you got a
Right, just
matrix
yes.
PC load letter. What the fuck? No.
Yeah.
I have this book called Slings and Arrows Comic Guide. It was a really fabulous guide. I wish they'd still publish it, but it's a catalog of every comic book ever published. And I think the last edition only goes to like 2003 or something like that. But before the internet, that's what you'd get if you wanted to know about every book. And
Yeah.
Puma Blues has an interesting description in it.
Oh,
It
yeah.
says it's complex, increasingly abstract work, so you're gonna have to app, and it's undoubtedly heartfelt. And it says at times it seems like there's no plot, just a series of observations on nature, human or otherwise. It's also an intense plea for the protection of the environment from future, bringing it depredation.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like Alan Moore called it quite impressive, quite ambitious. Neil Gaiman called it intelligent and urgent mythology for the end of the millennium, et cetera, et cetera. It looks like both of these creators also had a connection to Mirage Studios and did some work on Ninja Turtles stuff
Yeah, Peter
because of
Laird,
that. Yeah.
Kevin Eastman. But
But.
if you go to issue 20 of that series, they all do some stuff in there, like Dave Sim, Steve Bissett, Chester Brown, Peter Laird, Tim Truman, Tom Sutton, Alan Moore, Kevin Eastman, and Rick Veitch.
Oh,
So
okay.
that's a
Cool.
big a lot of big dudes.
Yeah, so it's pretty acclaimed. And I'm not totally put off by the description of it becoming more and more abstract. I mean, from this first issue, that's not totally clear, but it's also not totally, it's not also, I'm not totally shocked to hear that. I could see it going either way. So I don't think I'm gonna like rush right out and, grab the rest of the run. It looks like it ran for 24 and a half issues. There was like a mini comic, but I also won't say that I'll never read any more of it. Not the most enthusiastic endorsement,
Yeah.
but if it sounds good,
The
it
one
might
thing
be.
I will say about it is the covers are absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, that was one of the things that, like I said, I had never even heard of it, and it wasn't one when I was putting together this order, there were titles that I was particularly looking for or aware of, and this wasn't one of them. And that was one of the things because it's, we'll put up the cover of it, of this particular issue, but it's got a painted nature scene with this manta ray flying in. At a deer. And yeah, it's got weird idiosyncrasies like that that give you a little bit of a feeling that this world is different than ours, that there would be a manta ray flying in the forest. So yeah, I would agree with that though. The cover is pretty cool.
Yeah, just looking at the various covers, it looks like it might be a depressing read too.
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't really browsed through the rest of the series covers, but
They're amazing. They're all the you see the first one, they're all like that. Like it's pretty much just says Puma Blues, the issue number, and then has a painting on it.
Yeah, even from like a from a design standpoint, I like the layout.
Yeah, I've never heard of this. This is interesting. If anything, I would be interested in the covers. They're really nice. I wonder if the interior, does it match the cover at all, or?
Well, I mean, one difference is it's not black and white. Or I mean, it isn't. It is black and white. It's not in color. But I think it's the same. I think same artist. Yeah. So it's very. I mean, it's inked, but it's very. I don't know how to describe it. You know how like I wouldn't say it's exactly like Tom Mandrake's art, but you know that aspect of Tom Mandrake's art that makes you feel like you're really looking at pencil drawings? I would say, you know, I would say it shares that quality with it. And he really nails, like I said, this artist, I think he's done some like wildlife, and he's very like there is a puma that's kind of following him through the woods. And you know, there are some pages where he's in the forest and stuff, and you can tell he's got his wildlife down as far as you know, the anatomy of the animal and stuff like that. So
That's kind of cool because you always see sometimes that's the one part an artist could be awesome on human anatomy but not get the animal right. Yeah, that's cool.
yeah. Or just or get, you know, foliage and stuff like that can be a little, because there's just so much asymmetry and stuff like that, you know.
Right.
So
Nice. Interesting choice.
yeah.
I think my next one is Superboy 161. Features a cover of him throwing away his costume. We've all seen covers where Spider-Man's dropping his costume in the garbage can and you know the No More cover. Well, this one's kind of like that. It says you were leaving Smallville and his parents are saying, "Please don't leave your mother, your father, your town. You can never be a normal boy. You're Superboy." And this was a weird story. It was written by Frank Robbins, pencils by Bob Brown, who I'm not too familiar with, but I am familiar with Wally Wood, and he inked it. And this took place in 1960. I mean, this was a 1969 comic, December.
Oh,
And
cool.
it is an interesting comic. It's still kind of goofy as far as like what he could do, like Superboy could stop a tornado and that kind of stuff. But in this time, this is a 15-cent comic. In this time period, I notice a lot of Superman, Batman, and you know any kind of comic, especially DC. It might have been editorial driven at the time, but they tend to show you a shocking scene up front. And then they tell you the scene up to that shocking scene and then finish the story.
Yeah.
So it's like, bang, here's what you're gonna see. You know, Superboy's drinking a glass of kryptonite. What the hell's going on?
Yeah,
And
it's
then
like a second cover almost. Like the, you
it.
got like the cover is like some like extremely melodramatic scene, and then the first page is some extremely melodramatic scene, and then
Yeah, it's like getting you to buy the comic. Like if you open the first page, oh wow, what's he doing drinking kryptonite?
yep, totally.
But this is when Superboy's in Smallville, and it's interesting because he's there with Lana Lang, who he's got the hots for, like big time. But she ignores him. He's like it's kind of like a Peter Parker type thing, you know, where. With a Flash Thompson, there's this guy Bash, and he's like the Flash Thompson guy, and he's like a superstar quarterback, scores a lot of points, and he flirts with Lana a lot, and Lana gets all in love with him. And I guess back in the day they had dance cards. I don't know what the fuck they are, but I want to find out. I want to Google this shit. But it, these girls are like going up to Bash, fill my dance card for the victory ball tonight, please. What is that? It's like, are these cards and you'd get different dudes to sign them or what? I don't know what the fuck they are, but that's funny. Super Clark is very jealous, but he uses his X-ray vision a lot and he sees a tornado coming, so he grabs a circus tent and wraps the tornado in a circus tent. I don't know how you do that, but he wrapped it up in a circus tent and threw it out to sea, which is pretty cool. And he brings back Lana a pop, and then they're at a dance and Clark's dancing with Lana, and the other guy cuts in and Lana's like pissed because he won't. He lets her. She wants to dance with this guy, but she's mad that Clark just says, "Okay, go ahead," because he's like gonna beat the shit out of Clark. And Clark, at this time, he's like doubting his powers. It's almost like you watch the Superman movie and you see like Clark when he's always has that temptation to like be part of the football team or do something, but he knows in the back of his mind he can't. So
Yeah, they did that
eventually.
on Smallville a lot too.
Yeah, eventually he decides to get to start dancing with her again, and then that guy pushes him off and beats the crap out of him, and Clark kind of loses it. He's like, "You asshole!" And then he punches the wall and like breaks all the tile around the wall, but at super speed he's able to repair it. He's like, "Oh shit! I almost broke his face!" So he like repairs the wall real quick, and then he goes home and he's just real depressed, and his parents care a lot. They're like, "What, you know, you can't pretend or join football or whatever because of your powers." And he's like, at this point, sorry, I'm gonna say Peter Parker, but it is like Peter Parker because this Clark is smart, like really smart, like in the lab and stuff. So he actually goes into his lab and builds this kryptonite ray and hits himself with the ray to depower himself. It's kind of like in Superman 1, or was it 2? It was in Superman 2. Where he gets into that thing and he says, "I want to be with Lois. I want to lose my powers forever." And he kind of does that kind of thing. And then he challenges that guy to a fight. And he actually wins, even though he's not super powered because I guess because of all his years of being Superboy, you learn how to fight, right? So he knocks him on his ass in the boxing ring, and everybody's like, "Wow!" And then Clark decides to join the football team just as a regular person. And that one guy wants to tackle him, and for some reason, he decides to do it without a helmet. And Clark kind of grabs his head, like he goes for his legs, like he's gonna undercut his legs. And Clark grabs a hold of his head and pushes it down, and he goes smack into a bench, like. Hits his head, and all of a sudden he needs brain surgery and he's gonna die. So it's like, oh crap, you know, Clark's feeling all guilty. He's like, you know, I almost caused this guy to die, even though he didn't use his powers just because he jumped over him and he decided not to wear a helmet. I don't know why he was the only football player not wearing a helmet, but. And he feels guilty because now he doesn't have the powers, so he has to get the powers back. He manages to get the powers back so he could go fly out to like Germany and grab a professor and do brain surgery on this guy. And then Lana's all over Bash again at the end. But that was weird. That was a cool story though. It kept my interest the whole time. I was like, wow, this is pretty intense. This guy almost died because Clark dodged a tackle.
Well, it turns out you were right. That's pretty much what a dance card is. I looked it up. It's a dance cards used by a woman to record the names of the gentlemen with whom she intends to dance each successive dance at a formal ball.
Sign my dance card.
So it said in modern times it's used metaphorically. So if you say, you know, put me in your dance card, and you literally don't have one, it just means, you know, make sure we get a chance to dance tonight or whatever. But I guess in like the 18th and 19th century, it literally was, you know, they had a little booklet with a list of the different songs that would be performed, and they would write guys' names next to the different songs.
Slow songs. Let me love you down.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe they had like a little star next to the sexy jams for the special guys.
That's pretty cool.
But yeah, I gotta love those melodramatic covers, especially like DC Bronze Age. I always think of that one where where Superman's bringing Firestorm into the Justice League, and I forget exactly what they're saying, but it's just like, you'd have like superheroes on the cover, like calling each other like, shitheads
Yeah,
and
that.
not literally, but and then inside it wouldn't be nearly that bad,
I think of the one with the Justice League trying to get Black Lightning, and he's like, "No way, you jive turkey," or something like that. I can't remember that cover.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I just want to mention in this one was at the back, it's got a well-drawn schematic of his house. Like I guess he's got a basement that has like Kryptonian stuff in it, and like a little tunnel where Krypto can go in and out. And the other thing that's very interesting is this Clark was so smart that he built these animatronic robotic superboys that could act in his place. And the only thing that I thought was weird is, like, when there was a catastrophe happening, he would send he thought, well, if I lose my powers, I could send the robots. But the interesting thing is the robots lost the powers too, and I don't understand that for one bit. Why, just because he lost his powers, why would the robots? And the other thing to point out is the letters page. And this is even noted in my database, believe it or not. This is Superboy 161. Mark Evanier had a letter in here.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's saying this issue 158 was sensational! Exclamation point. Far be it for the backseat editor to use the term lightly, but it was excellent. Frank Robbins turned in what might have been a dull idea into an interesting plot characterization by action, novelty, and inventiveness. It wasn't quite like anything done before yet. It tied into what did occur before. As for the art, we can only praise Bob Brown for his bold drawings of Superboy and Wally Wood for the beauty of his outer space scene. So he was well, he writes good letters. But
Yeah.
Mark Evanier was a good friend of Jack Kirby, and he wrote a lot of independent comics, and he's known for writing with Sergio Aragonés on like Gru and a bunch of his other works. So yeah, that was very interesting. It's cool to see like creators that you know write letters in these books.
Yeah, I mean, back when there was no internet, that was definitely, I mean, people still do write letters and stuff, and there's sometimes comics will have a letter column, but that was that was a big part of the fan community back in the day. And there are guys that didn't, there's ones like that that have become known for other things, and some that just are known as prolific letter writers. I know I came across, I want to say it was either an issue of Micronauts or ROM one time that had a letter from Kurt Busiek in the back of it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because I guess, he was a big fan, wrote, I guess he wrote a lot of letters and stuff like that before he got involved in comics.
And I think a lot of
Just like,
writers did. In other words, they loved comics growing up and then said, "Hey, that's what I want to do."
yeah. And you didn't have the, I can imagine now with the internet and stuff, if you have an ambition to work in comics, you might have a little bit of self-awareness that, that there's this, in other words, it's like the internet's always there. You know what I mean? You know,
Yeah.
especially back then, where it wasn't as common to release stuff in trades. You just think, okay, well, this issue comes out, there's a letter in the back of it, and then, maybe you'll have back issue bins and stuff like that that people, and there was even a point at which, back issue bins weren't around, so you got the comic off the stands or you didn't get it,
Yep.
till the direct market came around and stuff, and they had to keep them. All right, well, I wrote another number one This one comes from Eclipse Comics, and it came out in 85. And this is Scout number one, Tim Truman. This is pretty much his baby. And this is about a Scout is a Native American hero. Basically, being this is the first issue, we get sort of a setup for the series. It's an 18-page story. There's also a backup called Fashion and Action by John K. Snyder III, which I started to read, and it's just totally, completely different than the main story. Didn't really make it all the way through it, but Scout, the main story, I did like. Essentially what's going on here is Scout is there's a sense that he's the next in a line of different Native American heroes. There's a spirit called Usen, U-S-E-N, who appears to him and kind of complains that this, you know, the Scout is who he's got to work with at this point, when, you know, in the past he's had Cochise, Nana, Victorio, different ones that he names, and but this spirit charges him with hunting down and killing four monsters that once roamed the world and have returned, but are basically, they've returned because they've been summoned by a white guy named Grail, the monsters are hiding in plain sight as humans. So he's charged with hunting these monsters down, and he's got this gun appears in different forms throughout his, you know, adventures. It seems like he first shows up as a like a praying mantis or mantid or something like that, along that lines. And then I think later on he takes a different form, like a chipmunk or a squirrel or something like that. He's hanging out on his shoulder. And he's kind of got like an irreverent attitude, brings some like... Scout takes out the first of the monsters in this issue. He's posing as a fat, bald pornographer. he's like, when you're introduced to him, he's on the phone. He's like, yes, CR, Little Housewives in Chains ships the 27th. Right. And tell Bjorn I can't wait for the pictorial. Just reprint the spread from Crazy Babysitters. The plant in Holland needs it by Thursday. Right. And he's got a girl that, named Missy, who's hanging out, calls herself Little Miss Strange, and she's only 17.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't think
not that's even legal.
Guys. I know.
That's 18, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. But he wants her to go upstairs and take care of these two fellas that show up. And she's like, oh, ready? You know, it's a little early, isn't it? And but he smacks her, and just in time, Scout shows up by throwing a grenade into the backyard. Scout's able to see the guy's real form, so he's like a giant owl man. And they have a battle. He's able to take him out, but in the end, it seems like this girl Missy is going to like kind of stick along with him or come along with him as he goes down tracks, and because of like in the process of taking him out, he like basically blows up the whole estate that this guy's living on, and intentionally makes a big show of everything because he wants to attract the attention of one of the other monsters who shows up in a nice like red Corvette or something, some kind of nice sports car. And it's kind of funny because there's two panels. One shows the guy as he's choosing to appear. He looks kind of like a you know, a 50s greaser or something like that. And then the next panel shows him as he really is, and his scout is seeing him, which is a bison. So it's like this like bison head chilling inside of a Corvette. And then that guy takes off, and you know, we get the, it says next little red rooster. So we get the sense that, you know, scout's going to head off and track down these other monsters and find the guy Grill that's responsible for it. So it's pretty cool.
Did you just pick up the first one, or did you pick up a couple?
I only got one. I think where I got it, they only had one, or they didn't have, you know, like they didn't have two and three or something. They had later issues, but I would like to read some more. It looks like, you know, this ran for a little while, and I think there was like a second series that dealt with Scout. But one thing I also want to mention that I thought was kind of cool is that the inside back cover is a order form that you can fill out and send to Eclipse to order some more of their comics, something you don't really see today. And some of them are listed as sold out, including a couple of the other. Like I also picked up the first few issues of Saber and DN Agents.
Ah, that's Mark Evanier.
Yeah.
It all comes around.
Yeah.
I read DN Agents. That's what. That's why I thought it was funny when we were reading Kirby and we had DNA Alien.
Yeah. Yeah. So those are listed as sold out, but all you had to do was wait 30 years and you could get them for 50 cents. But
you know, there is one company that still does that. Can you guess who it is?
Actually, it doesn't. Because I was just reading some Dan the Unharmable. Doesn't Avatar do that?
You got it. It's Avatar. Yeah. And that's, I missed an issue of Dan the Unharmable, and that's how I got it, is I ordered it directly from Avatar.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm going to have to. Cause how many of those are out? Is it out?
Dan the Unharmable is about eight, I think, or nine issues out right now.
So I have 1 through 6, and then I started pre-ordering it with issue 10, so I'm going to have to. 7, 8, and 9, I'm going to have to get just, you know, directly from.
Yeah, it's so good. I'm a big Avatar fan. Anything Laugh-Em is a guarantee I like. There's not anything that I don't like that guy writes. The only one that I don't buy because I'm just not into that is the he's doing that Marvel book, like a Age of Apocalypse thing.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm just not buying that.
I did read the first issue of that, and it's kind of like, well, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you know, it's kind of a job for him. I'm glad he has the gig, but
he's got the, yeah, that's what pays him the most. I don't think it's Dan the Unharmable that's paying him a lot.
No.
Unfortunately. No.
Well, and that even probably pays him more than, because it sounds like that's the reason he hasn't done any more Stray Bullets for such a long time, because, I mean, just money-wise, I think it was hard for him to get by.
Yeah. I got to meet Tim Truman at Baltimore this last year. Me and Keith went to a panel that he was in because he was a Kubert alumni.
Oh, okay.
And I just recently bought a trade, Hawken.
Oh, yeah, he did that with, like, his son or
his
something.
His son,
right?
Yeah. And yeah. I want to get into that for the other Geek Brunch. I have it sitting on my table to read.
Yeah, he seems like a cool guy, and there's a foreword. It seemed like this was pretty common with indie stuff in the 80s, that the inside cover would have some kind of a text. And Cat Ronwood. I'm not sure how to say it. I think she's, I'm looking here. I think she, maybe she's the, probably the editor or something like that. But, you know, prior to Scout, Truman was just known as an artist. And the text piece talks about how, you know, despite that, well, prior, at least when he made the proposal to do this, I guess in between the proposal and the time that this first issue came out, his graphic novel Time Beavers came out. I can't hear the word beavers without laughing because I'm a child. But so she just talks about how even though he hadn't done any writing in comics, how like him as a person and everything like that made her feel certain that he would do an interesting job. So yeah,
Yeah,
it's just cool.
he used to get a lot of I guess a lot of the alumni used to get some backups and stuff in DC War Books or whatever, 'cause Coop, that's where Kubert was plugged in, you know.
Yeah,
So
okay.
yeah.
Yeah.
I would like to get a Truman sketch if I go to a con this year and he's around. I have a Mike Grell one, which is one that I've always wanted, and he's done a lot of indie work too, and that this would be another one, another art sketch I'd like to get is from Truman.
Yeah, that'd be cool. 'Cause he was the artist on Grimjack, wasn't he?
Yeah,
Also,
very very sexy style. I like it. It's very I don't know, like I don't know who to compare him to, but it's a detailed style like Perez or something, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty anatomically accurate, I would say, and you know, not photorealistic or anything like that, stylized kind of. Yeah, I mean George Perez is not, wouldn't be too far off the mark because the design for Scout is really cool. You know, he's got like a gray, it's not like a cape in the superhero sense, it's kind of like more, he wears more like a poncho, but he'll swing, you know, swing the front of it back around, so sometimes it looks like a cape, and he wears just like a red bandana with a couple eye holes cut out of it, so it looks like something you just kind of put together. Not in the sense that he just like threw a bunch of shit on, but that like it doesn't look like, you know, something like these like superhero costumes that supposedly the, you know, person made themselves in their home, but looks like something, you know, you'd have to pay thousands of dollars for. This
Right.
looks like something, you know, he put together himself.
Yeah, if you're a fan of his work, I would recommend Hawk World. That's a book, a DC book that he wrote, the mini series he wrote and drew.
Oh,
So that'd be
okay.
a good one. And then I think he drew he didn't write, but he drew like the Jonah Hex Vertigo series. Really good stuff. I tend to know a lot of DC stuff just because that's. If you look at the bulk of my collection, the bulk of my collection's mostly DC.
I think everyone just dropped their iPod in shock.
Yeah. So I
Well, I
got.
saw Barb tweeted a picture of you last night, though. You were representing both companies. You had your DC-related shirt and your Marvel-related pants.
That's right.
You were bridging the gap between the publishers.
Representing. And sometimes I have my Valiant shirt. And I'm going to buy a Cross shirt. I didn't even know they had it until this previews. I'm buying Crossed.
There you go.
Yeah.
You can lift it up in front of your face and make people run away.
Yeah, that's what Bill has. This is when you call him on Skype, he's got a Cross face.
Oh my gosh, I have to minimize the window.
It'll scare you. Okay, the next one I had was awesome. I mean, it was, God, it was good. Atari Force number one. This was based on the video game, but or the video game company, and it introduces a couple of characters. One is Blackjack, Tempest. Let me see what the other one is. She's the main character, Dart. She's like the badass female. And then
Oh
there's,
yeah, isn't she's got like a mohawk or something?
yeah, well, no, she's
Or
got like a
tattoos?
ponytail, tattoos on the face, and white hair. And it introduces some other characters. Like there's this one child character that's huge, like a huge rock character, but they don't give a name for it. And what else do they introduce? They had so much stuff in this first issue. Oh, Pack Rat. It's a character that looks really weird. She actually it looks like a female, but I can't tell if it's a male or a female at this point. But that Pack Rat character is looks like they're all gonna become a team. The people that are on the team right now are Dart, Tempest, and Blackjack for sure. But this story is written by Jerry Conway, who's one of my favorite artists, you know, from the 70s-ish stuff. And I loved Atari at the time. Like, I played a lot of damn games. And I remember when one of them came out. I can't remember if it's Star Command or something like that, but it actually came with an Atari Force comic. And I don't know if I have it still or not. But I'm trying to find the year of this comic, and I can't find it. It's weird. Usually, it's right up in the front part.
What
But
point did you, is that, you don't really play video games nowadays, right?
I dropped off with the first generation Xbox,
Oh, okay, so it wasn't, I thought maybe it was just when you were a kid or something, but so it wasn't that long ago.
no, yeah. Here's I loved Atari, and then I went from Atari to. God, I can't. Well, I started off with the Fairchild, and I showed you that video.
Yeah.
It's like old. I went from Fairchild to Atari 2600. I think the next one was ColecoVision. There might have been something in between, but ColecoVision, Sega Genesis, Sega Saturn, and Xbox. And I love the Sega ones, but I as time went on from the I think around ColecoVision when I started going into this. Oh, I had a Nintendo in there first. The first generation Nintendo was before the Sega, and then I migrated to Sega. But once I got into Sega, I would play a lot of like Virtual Fighter, you know, just like the fighting games. But I started to like migrate totally to the sports games, and I ended up that way. Like I'd play Madden for hours or baseball. I'd go to my friends and play for hours or the racing games, but never really got into the first person shooters and all that kind of stuff. Just kind of stayed in that one. But at Atari, I was all over the place. And a lot during this time frame, they have a lot of ads, you know, for various games and such in this. And they even have a cartoon, like what cartoons to watch on Saturday mornings. And I watched this whole block because this was a big. I saw the cartoons that were showing on NBC this year. I can't find the year of this comic. It's unbelievable. Oh, in 1984 was the Flintstone Funnies. I never watched that. Although I was a huge Flintstone fan, I never watched the Funnies. The Shirt Tales, I don't even remember.
Oh, I watched them.
The Smurfs, I watched quite a bit. But I usually watch them to get into the other cartoons. Alvin and the Chipmunks, yeah, I watch them occasionally. Mr. T, now I watched Mr. T all the time. And I watched Amazing Spider-Man and the Incredible Hulk block. And then the last one was Thunder the Barbarian, which I absolutely loved. I even bought the, or I got for Christmas the Thunder the Barbarian complete collection. So I look forward to
Nice.
digging into that for maybe even this show.
Yeah.
But this is a cool comic. The artwork is by Jose Garcia Lopez. It's awesome art,
Nice.
very detailed. The inside cover has an interesting thing that Star Joes might be interested in. It's got the Masters of the Universe vehicles, but in this case, they weren't the vehicles, they were the models, like model kits from Monogram. It had
Oh,
like
okay.
a Talon Fighter. I don't know much about He-Man, but it had a Talon Fighter and a Tac Track. So that was interesting. But it opens up as Dart and Blackjack are busting the shit out of this place, and they're looking for this general guy, General Key, because they didn't pay. he didn't pay them. In other words, he gave them money to do a job. They did a job, and then he didn't want to pay them. So they're like busting up this place, trying to get their payment. And then the police show up, or they're called shock troops or something like that at the time, and they start shooting at them, and they have to escape, and they end up jumping out of a building. And Blackjack's pretty, I guess, having sex with Dart. They sound like they're lovers, but which he's lucky because she's pretty hot. But
yeah, I haven't read the series, but I've always liked the look of Dart. She's really cool looking.
Yeah, really cool. And then there's this other evil monarch that throws that general into an acid bath because he didn't do his job. I guess he was supposed to lure them there so he could kill Dart, but that didn't work out too well.
Throws the genital? Did you say genital?
Did I say genital?
I don't know.
General. He kills that general Kai that was supposed to drive Dart and Blackjack to this place to be killed because he didn't pay him, and the general ends up getting thrown in an acid bath. And then the scene cuts to these two pirates, and they go to this planet, and this guy's like, one of the pirates is like, why the fuck are we going here? They don't have anything that we could use or take. And they said they ended up taking this huge baby looking thing. And I guess these babies eventually turn into mountains, like their parents. If you look at their parents, they're like mountains. So they can move at one point when they're kids, and then they can't move anymore. They turn into a mountain. But he's actually trying to make this thing a slave. So that was interesting. And it looks like it has a baby mentality because it's crying like, wah! But and then they cut to Tempest, and there's this professor lady who's testing out Tempest, and he's got the ability to like open up portals, kind of like in Defender when you hit or Asteroids where you hit that button and you go hyperspace.
Mm-hmm.
He like can open up a portal, go through some hyperspace link, and then end up wherever else he opens up another portal. So that's like Tempest power, and he's got father issues, and they go into that, and he's got like a hot chick that he's dating that her father is a senator and hates his guts. And then they introduce Pack Rat, who's stealing stuff, and they don't pretty much all that they say is that she's headed towards Earth, and that's where the Atari Force is set up there. But it is an awesome first issue. It just looks beautiful.
Was that the first time you read it?
I think I've read this once before because mm-hmm. Keith Knutson loved this series. Keith Knutson's like the biggest Garcia Lopez fan that I know. Like, he loves Garcia Lopez. And I can see why. His art is just amazing. And I think he gave me most of the Atari Force at one of the conventions. Like, he bought it for me. He said, here they are. So I'm like only missing like two issues in the whole Atari Force. And I just got to get down to reading it. And this podcast is a good excuse to do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I want to get into, and the ads are awesome. You got Superman Creamy Peanut Butter. You got an ad for Bump and Jump, which was, this was an Atari 2600 game. It was like a racing game. The graphics wouldn't impress to, you know, today's people, but at the time, right, they were the shit. I mean, they were awesome. And then it's got an ad for Power Lords, and I never got into those, but I think the Star Joes have talked about them once.
Yeah, I love how in the old Atari game ads, they would show a picture of the graphics. Like, check this shit out.
Yeah, look at
this. It's like nowadays they'd probably hide that. Put a drawing in there or something.
Well, nowadays they show like the animation before the video game starts because it always looks better.
Yeah, I hate that. They do that a lot too. I mean, now though, things are getting to the point where it all looks the same.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a good stretch of time there where you're like, okay, now is that just the cutscene, or does the game actually look like that? Because it's probably just the cutscene.
Yeah, but Atari Force, that was good.
Yeah, that's cool. I would like to read that at some point. I've heard from so many different people, you know, because you initially hear the name and you think that it's just like a cheesy tie-in or something, and I've heard from so many people that it's really good.
Oh, it was great. And like I don't even know, like I don't think there was a blackjack game from Atari, but I wonder if that character's named after him. I don't remember where Dart came from, but I know what Tempest is. That was an Atari game. That's my wife's favorite, stand-up game at the
Oh, really?
time. Yeah, Tempest.
Yeah, I think any kind of connection was pretty loose. I think it was one of the things that made it good that, they weren't bound to make it strictly related to Atari other than a name, and can like make some connections, but not, it's not like an adaptation of a particular game or anything.
Yeah,
So
the one
that's
thing
cool.
I noticed is when Keith got me these issues, they're in really good shape. Like, they're not. That's borderline mint Atari for us right there. It's worth a whole 60 cents, probably.
Yeah.
The
Awesome.
price.
It's like that's you can make it the centerpiece of your collection. Pay like
I do want to read the Scouts, though, that you're talking about. Because of the Truman thing, because I'm reading Grimjack, and I think Truman did the Grimjacks, and I want to get the Scout. I don't have the Scouts.
Yeah, I think yeah, he did the art on Grimjack and then Scout. He did
Both,
both.
yeah.
Yeah, which yeah, I don't know how I'm gonna handle this because like I said, I got a whole bunch of different series. But like you were saying earlier, if I wait too long,
You'll
then
forget.
it's yeah. So, I'll probably pick up some, at least maybe if I read a few issues of the series that I end up liking here and there, keep it fresh in my mind or
If a
something.
series is really good or weird, you will remember getting you'll remember certain aspects. You won't remember the details. I found that out when I read US 1 number 2. I read number 1 a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah, and certain things will compel you too. Like, you might be planning to just sample something, and like, when I read, talking about Laugh-Em, when I read Young Liars last month or whatever it was, I got about three trades off eBay, and I was just going to read the first trade and then maybe go to something else and, flip back to it a little later on. And I could, I mean, I just read straight through all three trades because I couldn't stop, because it just, I just was so crazy and I had to know what was happening.
Samey.
Yeah.
I have a
Awesome.
Embats or Michael Batzel.
I know of them.
He painted
Forgot
me
to
a
talk about them.
shirt with Sadie on it.
Nice.
Pretty awesome. It's
That is awesome.
a picture of her. I think she's got the guitar on her back and she's snapping her fingers.
Oh, sweet. That's awesome. I had one more indie from the 80s to present. This one I actually read three issues of, and it took me a while. Not in a bad way.
Because it's dense, or
Yeah, because it's dense. And these are 30-page issues. These. So I had talked about on a previous issue. Episode I talked about Dreadstar, which is the first comic to come out from Epic Comics, Marvel's first creator-owned imprint. I believe that this one was the second one. This is Coyote. Have you ever read these?
I have not, but it's interesting that you mentioned it because I read US 1 number 2 and I always look at like the subscription services
Yeah.
and I saw like what was coming out this month and it said Coyote number 1 and I was like,
Nice.
I'm not familiar with that. What is that? That's weird. But
So
go
is that
ahead.
Epic Comics also then? Or
US
was
1
it?
is not, but they sold Epic Comics, I think. Either that or let me see. Yeah, it's under Epic Comics.
Okay.
So we read a comic that came from the same year,
Time
maybe
period.
even the same month, 1983, June.
Okay, this number one, it has April 1983 on the front.
Well, that's pretty damn close.
Yeah, but issue 2 came out in June because it was supposed to be bi-monthly. I say supposed to be because number 3 was late by like a month. So it was actually 3 months after, and they talk about it in the back of the issue. But yeah, this is so speaking of Altered Ego's podcast, they did an interview, which I recommend people track down. It's a really, really good interview. Very, very interesting and well done, with Steve Englehart. And he's the writer and basically like the concept creator behind Coyote. You know, he's written a bunch of different stuff for in the 70s, Batman, Doctor Strange, Captain America. And I guess at some point he had a falling out with Marvel. And then once things had kind of changed over and, you know, Jim Shooter was in charge and they created Epic, you know, he got interested in working with them again. The art on the first two issues was by Steve Laiola. And it's just kind of a coincidence, but Coyote also is sort of a Native American hero. I say sort of, I mean, he is, but his origin is kind of interesting and complex because he takes the form of a white guy, maybe, I think, an Italian guy. But he can kind of take the form of a normal human. But his origin, as far as he knows, is that his parents were a were-coyote and a psychic vampire. So that's an interesting origin, or that's some interesting parentage there. And, you know, I'm not going to be able to do this justice in terms of plot synopsis. And if I try to cover everything, you know, I'll put everyone to sleep. But like I said, it's dense. You know, the cover price is $1.50. Even at that price, like I said, I probably paid 50 cents an issue. But it's 30 full each issue is 30 full pages of story. And most pages, I don't even know if there are any splash pages to be found. Most pages have, you know, 7 to 9 panels on them. And there's just so much going on. So before Epic Comics launched any series, they had, I think it was Epic's Classics or Epic's Classified, something like that, where it was basically like a Dark Horse Presents kind of anthology comic, and a Coyote story appeared in some of the issues of that they then collected into a graphic novel. I didn't know that until after the fact, so it does actually pick up after that, but you get just kind of like, this is also what happened with Dreadstar, so you get a little bit of a recap and it catches you up. So I didn't feel like I need to have read that, though now I would like to. But basically there's this group called the Shadow Cabinet that are, you know, essentially like out to influence the world's governments and sort of in like a secret society Illuminati kind of way, control everything that's going on to their own benefit. And apparently like in the story that preceded this, the ongoing, Coyote ended up getting involved with them, running afoul of them, as they say, because he met a girl that was a part of their organization and got into a relationship with her, and she ended up screwing him over. And one thing about Coyote is just like the Native American legends of the Coyote as like a god figure and like a trickster, he's all about the ladies. Throughout the issues, they also recount like the Coyote myth as Coyote the character finds out more about his past, and he, as time goes on, he begins to wonder if he is a manifestation of the Coyote God or not. And he meets these two girls who are sisters, even though one's white and the other one's black. They have the same father. And the black sister turns out to be able to take on a kind of astral animal form like he can. And so, you know, he's involved with the Shadow Cabinet and infiltrating them and trying to get revenge. The Shadow Cabinet's being run by this guy called Half Dome. So it's a real crazy character. He's like a bald guy, and it's almost as if someone took half of the top of his head and sliced it out, because the leaders of the Shadow Council, or cabinet, they transported half his brain into another dimension. Basically, like, it says, half of his brain internally dwells in the anti-dimension thanks to shadow science, and that gives him, even though it's still, magically connected to the rest of his brain. And then the other guy is this dude, the Hood, that's a sorcerer, it wears this, like, gold mask. So there's just, like, all kinds of stuff going on. Like, the second and third issue have, like, thankfully a recap page, because, like, originally there was a couple months in between. There's so much going on, you know, in a good way. I mean, you can follow it. It's not confusing, but it's just really dense. And, you know, what happened in these three issues probably would take, like, 2 years nowadays. one final interesting thing was just that originally it looks like this was pretty much meant to be Englehart and Leola, but they talk about in the back of issue 3, before the letters column, Englehart explains why there was a delay in getting issue 3 out and why the artist changed. And in this issue, it's Butch Geiss. And then apparently, I don't know if he finished out the series or not, but Butch Geiss just kind of did this issue as a favor. And then apparently after this, Chaz Trug, Trug, who was new to comics at the time, comes in. So they had a little bit issue of basically getting the art done in time, which I can imagine, 30 pages. Englehart says that Leola found it impossible to do Coyote to his satisfaction within the agreed schedule. It took him 5 months to do Coyote 1, and then 2.5 months to do Coyote 2, and that was with rushing. So he basically bowed out because he didn't want to...
He was too slow.
Yeah, and he didn't want to half-ass it.
Yeah.
And
was he... I'm not familiar with his work, like, but I am really familiar with Butch Geiss.
Yeah.
Or Juice, or whatever you want to say. I've read a lot with him, but what art style did you like better? Like, you read 1 through 3, and Steve did 2 of them, and Butch did the 3rd one. Which one was better?
I would say I liked Geiss a little bit better. I mean, I liked Steve Leola. I'm looking him up now because I know his name more than I know his work. It's a familiar name to me. I know he's done a lot of stuff. Yeah, he worked on Fables? He's done all kinds of stuff. I mean, did the Firestar Mini. Looks like he's done lots of, like, issues here and there. Maybe because he did Secret Wars 2.
Yeah, I've probably read stuff with him.
I'm sure you have.
It's like something that just doesn't ring a bell. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think he does. I think he's been an inker on a lot of the Fables issues.
Oh, he even
That's
inked a lot of, well, at least a couple of Coyote issues as well.
okay,
Yeah,
maybe
he's
I can
listed
check
as
that.
the inker.
So I like his art, but Butch Geist is, like the characters are recognizable, but the models do look slightly different. I just find his stuff to be a little tighter. And they're fairly similar though. It's not like a shocking change.
Yeah, I like Butch's stuff a lot.
But
Like,
I've read Geist's stuff before, and I like his. I find like I said, Coyote's like all about the ladies. Like he's like those sisters. Like he first hooks up with the blonde one, and then her sister impersonates her and sleeps with him because she's in love with him because they have the connection of both. Being, you find out that she's actually has some connection to like the coyote god's wife. But anytime like he comes across like an attractive lady, he's like, oh my god, he's like he hits on like any woman that he comes across, even though he's like sort of the hero of the series. He's like very much a ladies' man, and it connects back to like the legends of the coyote, which is really kind of cool, like the way that they weave those in. One of the legends of the coyote is that he meets these two women and gets them both pregnant, and
wow.
so. But yeah, I like these a lot. I kind of did them in order of preference, I guess. Maybe it's just because, I mean, Scout might have been similar, maybe if I like kind of on the same level. Had I read a few more issues and got more into the story, because even with that, that's like 18 pages in the first issue, and so even on a one by one basis, there's more story in the first issue of Coyote. But yeah, this is really good stuff.
But that fashion thing didn't turn out like you wanted to read it, huh?
Yeah, it's just I don't know if it was just because it was so completely as a backup, it was so completely different. The art style is like real cartoony. It's just real kind of weird. I don't know.
Because
Not that I have
I'm
anything
liking
about.
Fashion Beast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this one sounds interesting too. I like Englehart, so.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Never read any of the books that you mentioned, so that's a good thing. Learning new stuff.
Damn, I'm gonna give myself like a no prize. Just for
I
finding comics that Mike Myers hasn't read.
have.
I get
Was
a star.
that your last one, or?
Yep.
I got two more, and I'll go through them quick.
Okay.
US 1 number 2. This one is written by let me see. I know the art is by Trempe, Al Milgrom. And this
Oh,
is
cool.
about a trucker that has like a metal plate in his head because he got in an accident and they had to add this metal plate, and it like gives him special abilities, like he could hear CB radio through his teeth. I don't know what the hell, but it's funny. This is a great funny comic and ridiculous. But it opens up as this trucker goes into a truck stop, and he says, "I'm the toughest trucker of them all." And he's like, "I want to take you all on, like, to compete." And then a whole brawl starts, and like 5, 10 pages of the comic are just him fighting everybody. And then US 1 shows up. His name is Ulysses Solomon Archer, and he's the main character of this book. And he starts fighting with them and gets his ass kicked pretty bad until he starts using his head, his metallic head, and he knocks that guy out. Well, this trucker was hired by this female that looks like a female Valkyrie called Midnight, and she's got this weird, like, barbed wire looking. It's a goofy whip, but it interferes with Ulysses's powers, like he can't do CB, and it'll make weird sounds in his ears and all that kind of stuff. But he ends up making out with some chicks at the truck stop. He buys some gum. This is just some cool shit. And then that gum that plays a part later on in the story. The the Wiggly spearmint gum.
Oh, really?
But he gets in his truck, he takes off. Midnight is on like a bike with her whip, and she chases him, and then there's this huge chase scene, and he's got his like rig like James Bond, like he could put oil slick, he presses the oil slick button. He's got rocket launchers, he shoots at Midnight, he's got like thumbtacks that tries to blow out her tires and she avoids it. And there's a huge chase scene, and then eventually she has to use her power of the whip, which will mesmerize him, and she has him pull over, and she then mesmerizes him to run his truck into a cliff so he'll die. But Ulysses is smart enough to take his Wiggly spearmint gum and stick it in his teeth. That metallic wrapping that Wiggly spearmint gum has, he uses to interfere with his cavities that he has in his teeth. And then her whip can't interfere with him anymore and mesmerize him, so he doesn't hit the cliff, and he kind of knocks her off her bike and he gets away. But this
Nice.
comic is ridiculously fun. I don't know why. I don't know who greenlit this, but God bless you. It's like, it's so different. I don't know how this made a Marvel comic. I could see it being an indie comic, but man. And it's got a ad for Lock and Chase. I used to play that game a lot. That was on the Atari. At least it was on the Intellivision, but Intellivision had a brand called M Network, and they made games for the Atari, so I played Lock and Chase. And it's got another M Network game for Tron, and I also had that one, the Deadly Discs, where you just throw a disc around and try to kill. It was kind of like Robotron. Do you remember that game?
No.
Yeah, these are way past your time. You
Well,
weren't even
I might have been alive, but just not
yeah.
playing video games
Yes.
yet.
But this
Nice.
is a great comic. I look forward to finishing it. I think it's only like 12 issues or so. But it is fun. I mean, and the art is so nice. Well, I don't know what happens. I think Trimpy only did 2 issues, and then they switch writers kind of like Coyote or artists. And I don't know what that's going to look like, but the art was really awesome. And the last thing I want to do is I want to finish up my Contest of Champions. So I actually finished the Jack Kirby book, and I figured I finished the Avengers Contest, so that's really good. I'm going through some of my hardcovers and finishing them.
Yeah, sense of accomplishment.
Yes, it is. And this one was really enjoyable. This is from Avengers Annual 16, and it concluded last time I talked about West Coast Avengers Annual, where they were fighting each other. Well, this one, the Grandmaster says, "I'll give you one more chance." He's like obsessed with games, and that's how what ends up defeating him. But he says, "I'll give you a chance. You Avengers will compete against." He brings all these characters back from the dead, so he brings back the Swordmaster, Nighthawk, Hyperion, Thrax the Destroyer, Black Knight, Dracula, Bucky, all these different characters, and they go head to head. So like in each, like in the previous one, they it'll say like Hawkeye, Thor, and Pym versus Executioner. And one thing I didn't realize at the time is that when Executioner died, I guess he saved Thor. So Thor had a hard time fighting the Executioner because he had just recently died saving him. And then it had Nighthawk versus Hank Pym, and Nighthawk ended up killing Hank Pym. And then it had a Swordmaster versus, or I keep getting, is his name Swordmaster? I keep forgetting his name.
There is a Swordmaster character.
Yeah, I think he's an Avenger. He was an Avenger. Swordsman. God. Swordsman. And he's got this cool sword that shoots lasers and stuff, and him and Hawkeye go at it. But Hawkeye ends up destroying the bomb. That's what their goal is. And but Thor and it appears that Thor and Hank Pym die. And then we got Captain Marvel, the one that's light, and She-Hulk and Moon Knight and Tigra fighting Drax the Destroyer. I guess he was dead at the time. You see him in the current Guardians of the Galaxy and stuff. Green Goblin, I guess Green Goblin was dead at the time, which was interesting. Death Adder and which was one of the Serpent Society characters, and I don't even know who the other one was, but they end up getting into it, and that one ends up in where the bad guys win, and then they got Silver Surfer versus Korvac. That was pretty cool. And we get Iron Man, Mockingbird, Black Knight, and Dr. Druid versus Dracula, Red Star, Terax the Tamer, and Black Knight versus himself, like his mentor. That was cool. And the last one was Captain America, the Wasp, Wonder Man versus Bucky, Baron Blood, and Hyperion. And it's interesting because Hyperion is going to play a Avenger now. I've seen
Oh, and the new.
the new Avengers,
Yeah.
but he in this book he almost just he must be like the Superman counterpart. I know he wasn't Squadron Supreme, but that wasn't on the Earth. This one was on the current Earth, and he beat the crap out of Wonder Man, which is kind of hard to do because Wonder Man's pretty much it. But they end up killing all the Avengers except for Hawkeye and Captain America, and then the Grandmaster says, "Well, now you have to fight all of the dead Avengers that you just killed." Then Hawkeye uses his wits and saves the day. He says, "Pick a hand. One, pick one arrow." And he says, "Pick the one that has the arrow tip on it." And he says, "Are you crazy? I'm ready to." Because Grandmaster's plan is to just have another Big Bang. Like he was created out of the Big Bang. And he's bored, he's extremely bored, and he wants to create another universe. So his goal is to recreate the whole universe again. But Hawkeye says, "Hey, pick one." And he basically, Hawkeye's not afraid to cheat, right? So he doesn't have the arrow on either one. Grandmaster picks one and then loses the competition. And then everybody's restored back to normal. And then they're back at the Houston Astrodome playing baseball. It's good.
Did you say Cap fought Bucky?
Yeah, Cap fought Bucky.
What Bucky was that?
It was the Bucky that had that funky costume. I mean,
Oh, okay.
the red, white, and blue costume back in the day.
Yeah.
Well, Bucky was dead for a long time until they brought him back as Winter Soldier, so.
Right. Oh, so wait, so oh, so it was just like a
Like him as his
fake.
Robin, that
Yeah.
Bucky.
Oh, I mean, but it was just like a fake Bucky.
No, it was really him.
Oh.
Graham,
Wasn't he supposed to be dead
they
then?
yeah, but they brought him back all from the dead.
Oh, right.
Because Grandmaster was holding Death as a hostage and was able to
Yeah.
use her powers because he was absorbed Death's powers to bring back all these characters from the dead. So even though a lot of these characters were good, and they were heroes, they were still fighting for the bad guy.
Gotcha.
Yeah. That was good. It's a fun series if you like versus, like this hero versus that hero and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Enjoy it.
Cool. Yeah, I was gonna say with that US one, did you say that was Al Milgrom that wrote that?
Yeah.
Okay. But I never heard of it. I mean, I've heard of Al Milgrom for a lot of different things, but I think that he was an Wasn't did, was it regular Marvel that it came out under, or
Yeah,
did you say it was Epic?
it was regular Marvel.
Oh, okay. Because I think he was involved with Epic, so maybe I was thinking maybe that was how it got published.
No, this guy had even some like crossovers with Marvel characters. I think issue one had Ghost Rider in it or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was like one of those weird titles like Team America, which is another one I want to get into. That you're like, why are they publishing this?
Yeah.
it That one is just like, man, it's like fun to read. Just because it's like, why? This is just about a truck stop and a trucker who has a metal head. But
Well, and
he lost his brother in issue one, like, and he's trying to solve that crime. So he is going after somebody called the Highwayman.
Nice. Cool. All right, switch move into the middle segment. Next segment.
Sure.
Play the music. High production values.
So this was like a last minute topic that I thought of.
Yeah.
And I just thought we'd pick our favorite movie from the year that we graduated high school.
Yeah, that's a cool idea. So, what
So
was that for you?
I think we could alternate. Like, I'll do one, then you do one. But my year was 1987, and these are in no particular order. But well, I'll tell you what my favorite one was: Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Nice.
I love that movie, and that's a movie with Steve Martin and John Candy that. Those aren't pillows. I'll still watch and reference, and I'll watch it every year because it's kind of like a holiday Thanksgiving type movie to watch because that's what his goal is. It's to get across town when his flight goes to shit and he has to partner up with John Candy to get back home virtually on no money.
Nice.
But I enjoy that movie quite a bit.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like both those guys,
And of all the
comedians.
movies that I mention, this is one that I pretty much watch every year or every other year.
Now, did you see that one at the time it
Yeah,
came out?
we saw it at the theaters. I think it was a John Hughes movie, and I'm not sure, but
It
I
is.
was a huge John Hughes fan. Like, I'd see everything John Hughes.
I think, I'm 10 years younger than you, but I assume that was required if you were in high school in the 80s. You probably would have been like ostracized if you didn't like John Hughes movies.
Yeah.
Most of them I saw after the fact.
Teenagers.
But yeah, so like I said, I graduated in 97. I'll do mine. I did a top five kind of.
Yeah.
And I kind of picked, I mean, there's, I took a look at a list of movies that came out that year, and there are some that, like, maybe objectively, I might have seen more recently, and critically might have been more objective. But I basically picked ones that I saw around that time that have stuck with me, or at least had, like, a pretty big impact on me at the time, you know? So I'll go reverse order. My number five was Gross Point Blank.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, and this, I definitely, some of the soundtrack definitely played a part in it.
Have the soundtrack.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of it because, I was like in high school, and when I was graduating, I still was like pretty into like punk and indie music and stuff. And one of my favorite bands since like high school has been The Clash, and Joe Strummer from The Clash was in charge of the soundtrack, so that's part of why it was good. But it has The Clash on it, has English Beat, The Specials, The Jam, Violent
That's
Femmes.
my favorite right there, the Violet Femmes. I love the Violet
Yeah,
Femmes like nobody's business.
it has Blister in the Sun, which is probably their, I would say maybe their best known song.
Yeah.
So it's a really good soundtrack, and it kind of connects into the movie because if you haven't seen it, this is Joan, John, yeah, Joan, John Cusack, even though Joan is in a lot of his movies. Oh, and she's in this one too, his sister. But he's a hitman who gets sent back to his, he's encouraged to go to his 10-year high school reunion in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. And he doesn't want to go, but to encourage him to go, his secretary books him a contract, somebody to kill in his hometown. And when he gets there, he reunites with his high school girlfriend, who's played by Minnie Driver, and she's a radio DJ. So that's kind of where. Why there's like so many songs on the soundtrack, because she's working as a DJ, she plays a bunch of stuff. So Dan Aykroyd's in it also as like a competing hitman, also Alan Arkin. It was fun. It definitely was like, especially because of the soundtrack and stuff, hit me where I was at the time.
That's cool. I like that movie.
Cool.
All right, my next movie is Predator. This is the Arnold Schwarzenegger original movie. And I remember seeing this one with friends at a drive-in. So this was like probably in the summertime or something when I saw it, I guess. Either that or it was really cold. I don't remember. But I really like this movie. And I still like it. I think it's one of the better Predators of all the Predators, and the Predators versus Alien is still my favorite. And I don't know what, if it's my favorite just because of nostalgia, it's nostalgic to me. But I like it a lot. And it has Carl Weathers in it, if I remember correctly, and a couple other big names, but I don't need to describe the plot because probably everybody that's ever seen it, there's an alien and there's a military group that is getting hunted down by the Predator. And,
Yep, Carl Weathers is in it.
yeah.
He was. No, wait, that's. Yeah, he's Apollo Creed. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Apollo Creed.
Nice.
A cocky guy who was so cocky he got killed in a boxing ring by a Russian.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, well, my next one, my number four, is Gattaca. Gattaca. I like it, but I can't say it. This is a science fiction starring Ethan Hawke, Uma Thurman, Jude Law. It's basically a version of the future where eugenics is kind of out of control. When people have kids, they, they plan everything ahead of time. They pick the best traits of their parents. And, people who just basically have kids the old way are looked down upon, called invalids. Kind of like invalids, but invalid, because the ones that are created this new way, pre-selected and everything like that, are called valids. So that's, it's kind of interesting plot, and just the movie has like a nice futuristic look to it, and I like science fiction and all that, so I always thought this was, it's a movie it's I've was always found kind of rewatchable. I've seen it a bunch of times. Happens to be on.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, really? I think you'd like it. It's pretty cool.
right, my next one is The Lost Boys. This one
Nice.
is still one of my favorite. It has a really good soundtrack as well. And it's a story of Corey. It's basically Corey Haim and Corey Feldman are the heroes. Corey Haim and his family, his mother, move in with their grandfather and his older brother into a town. I can't remember where it is. Is it California or Florida? I can't remember.
I think
But
it's
it but
California.
it's a beach town, and it's haunted by vampires. And these vampires are like Kiefer Sutherland, and they're teen. I guess you could say they were attractive teens at the time, I guess, and they can lure in women easy. And I think Jamie Gertz was in it. She was the female that was protecting a little boy. And the older brother actually gets bit and becomes a vampire, and he has to fight like his wanting to drain the blood of his brother and all that stuff. But Corey Haim teams up with the Frog Brothers, and I think they basically team up again in Lost Boys 4 or 3. I can't remember which one. But it's the original Frog Brothers, and they kill the head vampire, and they're able to restore their family back to the way they were. But it's got a lot of humor in it, and it's cool because the Frog Brothers work in a comic store. And I've always liked it because it's like a vampire. It's like a cool vampire movie. Like, it's cool to be a vampire kind of thing.
It's like sexy, but the vampires definitely are evil.
Yeah.
Like Kiefer Sutherland, it's really good in that.
Really good, yeah. It's a fun movie to watch. And all the sequels have taken a nosedive, so
Oh yeah.
I can't recommend all the sequels other than I watch them just because I feel a compulsion to do so. But I can't recommend any of them.
No, they're totally like cash-ins,
Yeah.
you know. But yeah, and I think I'm not sure if it got in or not, but I know that they originally, like when Corey Feldman was doing the three or whatever it was, where the Frog Brothers were back in, you know, they were trying to get Corey Haim involved, and due to his drug problems and stuff like that, he only ended up filming a like a post-credit sequence where he appears and he's actually, his character's become a vampire. And I don't know if they ended up using it or not, but like that's all they were able to get on film because his drug problems were so out of control at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, I like that one too. All right, well, my next one is The Game.
That one's a fun one.
Yes, yeah, a David Fincher directed movie with Michael Douglas and Sean Penn. You know, I mean, I just, this one, a lot of people have pointed out plot holes in it, and it's essentially Michael Douglas is this like real successful businessman and stuff, and he's really not too nice to anybody. Most of his like relatives and people around him and stuff are pushed away, and Sean Penn plays his younger brother, and he gives Michael Douglas as a present. He gives him, he puts him in this game, which is basically like this company makes a game out of your life, and you have to like follow these clues, and it just gets increasingly complex and more and more dangerous, and that you know, he gets to a point where he feels like you know, his life is being threatened, and it kind of has like a twist ending to it and stuff, and you know, it's very like high concept, but I always just found it was very fun, a fun movie to watch, and you know, if you're willing to go along for the ride, it's a pretty entertaining, fun film.
Yeah, I agree. I've only seen that movie once, though, believe it or not.
Yeah, I think I've seen it. I saw it around the time it came out, and then I watched it again a few years ago, I think.
I think all the movies I've mentioned, I've seen at least 5 times, if not more. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, a lot more. My next one is Lethal Weapon.
Nice.
Big fan of all the Lethal Weapon movies, but this was. Every now and then you get two actors that work really good together. And when I saw Lethal Weapon, I was like, man, this guy would make a good Wolverine. Because, well, Mel Gibson could switch into this mode where he just turned into an animal. And you pretty much see it in the first one, but not so much. It kind of tapers off in the other ones. But he's got like a he can go into Wolverine Berserker mode in Lethal Weapon, but it I'm not gonna go into the plot for Lethal Weapon, but Gary Busey, I believe, is the villain in this one. Oh, no, he's not. Is he the real villain or is he just the henchman? I can't remember, but
I always get that number two mixed up in my head.
They have a huge fight scene in the lawn, I think.
Yeah,
And
like on I think it's on
Danny
the
Glover's lawn.
yeah, front lawn, yeah.
Yeah. But it introduces Danny Glover's family and all that stuff, and I like that movie. So
That's
that's
a good one.
like mine are in no particular order, but I'd say Planes, Trains is my favorite. I think I own every one of these movies too on DVD.
Yeah, I never really thought about the Mel Gibson Wolverine idea, but at the time, like in that character Riggs, I mean, it's so, one of the things I love about that is like his character is so insane, especially at the beginning, like how suicidal he is.
Oh yeah, he's almost like Deadshot. You know what I mean? Like Deadshot. What makes Deadshot so dangerous in the comic books is he doesn't care if he lives or dies.
Right.
And he's almost like has a suicidal witch, and that's kind of like Riggins.
Yeah, like he's still working as a cop and stuff, but he risks his own life because he doesn't really care if he dies. Like when he takes the guy off, he just grabs the dude and jumps off the building with him. Yeah, he's a really awesome character, especially in the first movie. Nice. So my number two is Good Will Hunting.
Ah, that has a link to your first one.
Mini Driver?
Yeah.
Yeah. you know, I haven't watched this in a long time. It's like I don't really feel compelled to at the time. You know, it's definitely a really well-known movie, and it received a lot of acclaim. Started two careers, and those two careers, you know, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, I mean, they're such huge stars now. Everywhere you turn around, those guys are, I mean, I think they're both talented. I'm not, I have to admit, I mean, it's a quality movie. You know, it stands up, and, you know, especially at the time, I connected to the story. And I was also a fan of Robin Williams.
How did you connect? Were you awesome at math, or?
No, not really.
You like fighting at bars.
Yeah.
How about them apples?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have a genius level intellect, but I work a crappy job. And no.
You finish equations for other people when they're not around.
Right, yeah.
You're bored.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I connect necessarily like on like a like this is my life kind of level, but
not like Karate Kid where you were actually in karate.
Yes, yeah, where I was also where I was actually a white belt in
yeah.
karate. And made out with Elizabeth Shue a lot when I was a kid.
I thought of you the other day because every time I go to Target, I look at the DVDs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new horror movie, and I don't remember what it's called, but it's like kind of like the House on the Left, kind of like, or you know how there's the Last House on the Left. It's not mm-hmm. quite that, but it's something brand new. But mm-hmm. Elizabeth Shue's in it.
Oh.
And I was like, I'm a big fan of horror movies, so I was like, wow, this looks weird. And it had Elizabeth Shue, and I was like, hey, that's Chris's woman.
yeah, I'm trying to think of what that was. Oh, okay. Here it is. House at the End of the Street.
Yeah.
Jennifer Lawrence is in it.
Mm-hmm.
Also. Yeah, so, I mean, it's a pretty good movie. I mean, it was one of the bigger movies of 1997, and I will mention that one thing about 1997 was when it comes to movies, like all anyone ever talked about was Titanic. That was the year that Titanic came out, and I mean people were so obsessed with it, and especially because I was like an 18-year-old kid at the time, like I like just could not stand the way that people were like flipping out about Titanic, and I still and so I refused to go see it. Like everyone in the world was going to see that movie, and I just refused, and to this day I still have not seen it.
Until recently when they re-released it in 3D IMAX, then you went to go check it out.
Yeah. No, it's a principle. I've gotten this far, I'm gonna die without seeing it.
It's not a bad movie.
Yeah, no, I at this point, like, it, now that I'm older, like...
Like, my Barb will always put it on that movie. I don't think she, like, it's one of her favorites, but when it's on, it's... So I've seen it more than once, or parts of it more than once. I never really sit through it the whole damn... Because it's a long-ass movie.
Yeah. Now I don't care. Like, I don't have the attitude about it that I did at the time, you know, because I thought I was, like, you know, somebody that, you know... Like Bad Religion wasn't going to be watching Titanic then.
Yeah.
But now it's more of just like keeping up the streak of not seeing it.
Can't forget to say that Robin Williams was in Good Will Hunting too, because he was awesome in that. It did win some Academy Awards. I know for sure it won like screenplay or whatever, because Affleck and Damon won, right?
Yep. Yeah, and some people like wanted to accuse them of not actually writing it and that, you know, but no, I liked, especially at that time, Robin Williams had a streak of appearing in serious roles after being known mostly for comedy, and I liked him a lot in that. And like Dead Poets Society's real similar role and stuff.
Good Morning Vietnam.
Good Morning Vietnam. Yeah. So that definitely, he definitely drew, I mean, it's a serious movie, he definitely drew on his like improv and comedy background there.
Well, according to Garp, that was depressing as shit.
Fisher King.
Yeah.
Was a good one for him. I saw a 1 hour photo. It's like totally different role for him.
Yeah, that was like, disturbing as hell.
Yeah. He's like bald and super, super creepy.
Yeah. He's a guy that can do a lot of different parts though. He's a Mark and Mindy, Nanu Nanu, Shaz Butt.
Yeah. This movie was also known for at least part of the soundtrack, because it had a lot of Elliott Smith on it.
Ah.
Who's since passed away. But I remember it being really weird. Like Elliott Smith is like a, you know, an indie songwriter and stuff, and seeing him because of the it was nominated for an Academy Award for his song, but actually ended up losing to a song from Titanic. But seeing him like appear on the Academy Awards and play was really, really surreal.
Right. All right, so for my last one, this is kind of a weird one. And I was torn between this one and RoboCop, and I chose this one.
Nice.
But I'm going to go with Some Kind of Wonderful.
Oh, cool.
It's another John Hughes movie.
Yeah.
And another great soundtrack. John Hughes had good soundtracks.
Oh, definitely.
But it's a teen angst movie. You know, a guy kind of grows up in the poor side of town. And he's conflicted with the rich. It's pretty much the same plot to Pretty in Pink, but with just different characters. Holtz is the character, and he falls in love with a girl who's on the rich side of town. She's pretending to be on the rich side of town. She's kind of in between, I think, or she's in the in crowd, even though she's on the wrong side of the tracks, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And she's dating other rich guys, but. He becomes fascinated with it. One thing I remember about this one is the girl that's on the drums is Eric Stoltz's best friend, and I can't remember her name, but she's a big actress too, or somewhat a known name. But she's his best friend, and she falls in love with Eric Stoltz, but's afraid to tell him because they're just like the best friends. And he's very jealous, or she's very jealous when he starts to go after Leah Thompson. And it all has a happy ending, but that's a great movie.
Mary Stuart Masterson.
There you go.
Yeah. That's actually, I think that's one of Kara's favorite movies.
There you go. That's a good movie.
Yeah.
So you'll see a lot of John. If we do these years in reviews, you'll see a lot of John Hughes movies showing up.
All right. Well, I'll mention also another thing that was significant about '97 and movies was that I didn't count these, but this was the year that the special editions of the Star Wars movies came out, and I did go to the theater and see them. Which has kind of like reawakened my like Star Wars in my life, because I had seen them a lot and played with Star Wars when I was a kid, and you know, got a chance to go and see them in the theater and stuff. And and I can remember watching Empire Strikes Back, and I actually like almost teared up when Yoda came on screen, because I was so excited to see him. But I didn't count those as new movies. So my number one is actually The Fifth Element.
That one's
Bruce
another
Willis,
good one.
Mia Jovovich, Gary Oldman. This is by Luc Besson, and it's also another science fiction one. Partially, I mean, just rewatchability. I mean, I've seen it a ton of times. It's Bruce Willis's. He's a cab driver in the future, and a Mia Jovovich ends up in his cab, falls into his cab, and he ends up getting wrapped up in this big plot to save the world. Have to like combine these four stones, and Gary Oldman has this extremely over-the-top performance as a bad guy trying to you know, oppose them from saving the world, and Mia Jovovich is like, has this like crazy skimpy like futuristic outfit on most of the time. And
might point out that it's still done by cosplayers today quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah, really, that one really stuck with people. The Lilu, her character's name is Lilu. She's kind of connect, ends up being kind of connected to the whole, you know, I guess you would say like the mechanism to save the world. And yeah, it's just, I've seen it a whole bunch of times. It's a really fun movie. You know, but I would say, like, you know, as it turns out, I wouldn't say like the late 90s were like a big time for me in terms of like, none of these movies would actually be in my real top five or even top 10 probably. You know, a lot of the stuff that, like, if you put my list up against the ones that you mentioned, ultimately, like, I probably would like the ones on your list slightly better, at least, just because I tend to, like, a lot of my favorite movies, though I didn't see them at the time, when I saw them later on, a lot of the stuff I really like comes from, like, the 70s and the 80s. You know, it's kind of cool because it does, obviously, those movies I didn't see in the theater, so, you know, yeah, it brings me back to like some of the experiences of actually going to the yep, theater and stuff like yep, that. So,
and these would, I think, Planes, Trains might make my top 10, but the other ones wouldn't.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting if you look at the big picture, like of what I saw when I graduated and what did they mean in that at that time.
Right, yeah. Did they stay with you? Or,
yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah. So yeah, it was a cool idea, though, to look.
Yeah, cool. I'm going to have to put some Gross Point Blank songs into this episode.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
All right.
Lots of good ones to choose from, that's yeah, for sure.
I have that soundtrack, so that shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, I don't know if I have the actual soundtrack or I know a bunch of the songs that are on it and their actual albums and stuff.
Well, I have the Planes, Trains, and Automobiles thing, but it's a Book of Love song, and I like it a lot, so I might put that in there too.
Nice.
All right, we could jump into completing our Jack Kirby's Fourth World Omnibus, Volume 1.
Volume 1. Yes.
And I have mixed feelings about one of the issues in here, but all the other ones I liked quite a bit.
Yeah, so did I. I might be the same issue, but yeah.
My favorite, I would say, is the New Gods one. And artistically, it's been my favorite, like, across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what if it is. It's like the designs and stuff like that or what, but...
Yeah.
It looks larger than life, and... the character designs are better than any other of the issues. And this one really I liked a lot. The next one I liked a lot, I think, was the Jimmy Olsen one, 138, which seemed mm-hmm. to wrap up a storyline, actually. And then I would pick Mr. Miracle as my third, and then the 139 with the Don Rickles was my least favorite.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I don't know Don Rickles. Like, I know he's a comedian, and I've seen him on, like, some late-night TV shows, but he didn't resonate with me, I guess.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, obviously, I didn't grow up with him either. I know him. I mean, I've seen him on different things. I didn't grow up with him. I don't have an affinity to him. And also, I mean, I kind of almost wanted to call... what is it? It's not, I mean, it's Goody Rickles is like
Yeah.
doppelganger or whatever. I feel like he's kind of, I almost want to say he's like the Jar Jar Binks of the fourth world. Because he does the same thing. I mean, it's like during a fight, everything
Yeah,
that he does good, he does by accident.
that's a good analogy, Jar Jar Binks. So he actually felt like that. That's why I didn't care for him.
Yeah. I wouldn't say he's as bad as Jar Jar Binks because there aren't many things that are, but but yeah, that's my comparison. And yeah, mine are kind of the same. I mean, I would maybe flip-flop Jimmy Olsen 138 and Mr. Miracle 3 maybe, but they're all kind of around the same level. Whenever I sort of order my preference to the issues that we covered, it's always pretty close. It's not like there's huge gaps in between, you
Yeah.
know, my feelings about them, because it's across the board. But yeah, I think I kind of agree with you too, with the New Gods being impressive conceptually, just because A, that's where you tend to get a lot of the characters that have you know, that have like lasted for posterity and been used, and where you get some of the most original designs there at that, and like maybe Mr. Miracle too. That's just maybe the second most place.
It even seems, though, to me, and that maybe the art style in New Gods seems slightly different to me. It seems more like Kirby lines that I'm used to than any of the other books. So, I don't know. Like that splash page with the black racer is so awesome.
Yeah.
I always found him visually striking. But let's dig into 138.
Sure. Everybody's in this one. It's a blast, the big boom. Don't be a chicken. It's throwing down the gauntlet. Read
Yeah.
all about Doomsday.
This is when all hell's breaking loose with the DNA alien, and he's attacking where, the place where everyone's at. And stealing all the energy. And I think in last episode, they're all stuck in a bubble, like a bubble of goo, right? And this takes place after it.
Yeah, we saw last issue they had a hard time. Superman and friends here had a bit of a challenge just dealing with one DN alien, and we saw at the end of the last issue that there was that Makari and Simeon were hatching a whole bunch of DN aliens. But yeah, you're right. This does kind of 139 continues the story in a sense, but this does resolve a lot of things that have been going on since the first issue of Jimmy Olsen that Kirby did.
I like how when they're stuck in the bubble and they're describing it as the yolk and hatching and all that crap. And Gabby has his foot against Scrapper's face and you can see it's all mushed up. They're trying to escape.
Yeah, so they're
Oh, this issue had the jack-off scene too. We gotta talk about that. Yeah,
I know what you're talking about because I saw that you tweeted a picture of it. If you want to explain what you mean.
they're in this ball of yolk, or they can't penetrate it, and he says, "Well, how did this DNA alien escape, hatch out of this thing?" And he did it through energy, and he needs to generate energy. So there's a panel in here where it says Superman rubs his mighty palms violently together. The results are a spectacular burst of crackling energy. And it's got like his hands moving like in a jack-off motion. And he says, "By golly, I'll bet I am." I don't know what that's about, but
I mean, in the preceding panel, I think it's Gabby that says, "You could be a walking dynamo."
oh yeah.
So I think that's easier to spot out of that. But yeah, unfortunately, I mean, it does look like somebody rubbing their palms together, but if you didn't have the caption, it also, because of there's motion lines all over the place and they kind of connect down to his crotch area, it definitely could also be what. And there's just a huge explosion of pink Kirby crackle. So apparently that's what
That's
That's
the
what
jits.
that's Kryptonian cum.
Yeah. But if you read it out of context, it really, I looked at that panel, I was like, man, that's nasty.
Well, hey, though, it gets the job done.
Yeah, it worked. So if you ever caught in an egg yolk that you can't break out of if you jack off really hard, it might work.
It's kind of ironic that he's doing to try to escape an egg.
Yeah.
As opposed to enter an egg.
But it worked. It got them out. So Jimmy Elson and three of the or all, actually all of them were in there, got escaped. And then you get a weird scene where it cuts back. Like, I don't even know why this was there, to tell you the truth. It cuts back to Perry White, and they introduce this character, Terry Dean. And maybe she was there in before Jack Kirby came along.
Mm-hmm.
But
I don't know.
Or maybe she's going to play a part in some upcoming issues. But I didn't see what this whole scene was about, other than Jimmy Olsen's missing, and he suspects Morgan Edge has done something.
Yeah, I realized when we got to this page that he hadn't shown up at all. We don't really know what his deal is. We don't realize until at this point that he's still, you know, involved with the Daily Planet under the Morgan Edge regime. But it doesn't really. I expected it to, you know, kind of play a part later in the issue, and doesn't. But we get into the wild area where all the DNA aliens that we saw hatching at the end of the previous issue are, and Makari and Simeon are getting ready to put a full assault on things, while Superman and Olsen and all the armies and troops and stuff like that from the project are heading that direction to confront them. We check back in with Morgan Edge, who gets contacted by the Inner Gang, and he gets the F out of there.
That I found kind of humorous, didn't you? He's like, I'm going to blow up the city, and then he's just working hard to get out and get in that helicopter.
Yeah. I mean, he lies to his staff, says that he...
yeah, go ahead and take... whoever wants to be in charge today could go ahead.
He's like, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to hang around for the big award that we're getting, but any one of you can just take my place. It's you, the little people, who've helped make Galaxy what it is.
That was great.
And then he goes to the roof and gets like, can this heap get away in time? So he's like actually like freaking out.
Yeah.
But he's going to die around with the little people that he's leaving behind.
And Superman and DNA alien get into it. And
yeah.
Simeon and Makari have launched all the other ones, and it actually looks like, how the hell are they going to get out of this?
Yeah, I mean, ever since the last issue, which I think they did a good job of, I mean, it's like seems like a huge threat because, you know, they had a hard time dealing with even one, so you know that they're not going to be able to take on this. I mean, you've got there's no real exact sense of how many, but there's at least like a dozen or more. So there's no way that even Superman, and with the help of the Guardian and all these other folk, are going to be able to take them on. They're going to have to, like, you know, take care of them some other way. Which I guess essentially they open up the floor. Is it the Zoom way that they're on where that's happening?
Yeah.
And they, you know, the whole thing with the, they figure out, you know, the whole thing with the DNA alien that they did face, that they are attracted to, like, nuclear energy and stuff. Nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they basically follow the source of the energy that they're after right down to, like, a pit in the earth that destroys them.
Yeah, it's a weird tunnel. It's like, why would you have that tunnel? Why does it go to the center of the earth? It's convenient. It's
Yeah,
like,
some
I'm gonna
kind of.
pull the reactor and throw it into this hole, and but it worked out very well.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of a quick resolution, but didn't feel like so cheap that I was annoyed by it.
No, because it made sense. They're
Good
attracted to the
stuff, yeah.
reactor. Get rid of the reactor,
Yeah.
and
Yeah, I
then.
mean they're gonna have to take care of them some fa like I said, some fashion other than straight up one-on-one.
And what do you do when you save the world or Metropolis? You celebrate afterwards. Well, not in this issue.
Yeah, what's
They give Superman the shit because he didn't include them, so they're
Yeah.
sulking.
Yeah, I like that about the Newsboy Legion, that they're more concerned whether they get to be in the action or not
Yeah.
and whether the world is saved.
They don't care. It's just as long as they were there.
Superman says, "Oh, so you young people are sulking, eh?" And Jimmy Olsen says, "Yes, you guys have no right to hog the nitty-gritty market." I like that, the nitty-gritty market.
Yeah, and then is it Gabby that says, I can't get them confused. He says Superman is out, soreheads are
That's Gabby. And the Guardian defends Superman, but he saved the project, the millions in Metropolis. Superman saved us all. And Gabby just says, "So, what does he want? A good conduct medal?" The total brats, man.
was great.
They're not impressed with Superman at all.
Yeah. So that leads us into New Gods number 3, which has the Black Racer on the cover. Is this the first appearance of Black Racer, right?
Yep. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I don't know if you read the afterword, but Marc Evanier points out that Kirby didn't even originally create the Black Racer for the Fourth World, and but they really wanted him to keep including new characters, so that's kind of ended up how he ended up sticking him in.
And he's a unique character because he's kind of like Death. In other words, he's kind of like what is that guy that comes to Death with the sickle comes to visit you and you're gonna touches you and you die? Well,
Yeah, like the
that's
Reaper,
yeah,
kind
the
of.
Reaper. He's the Grim Reaper of the Fourth World. And he's chasing Orion, and I don't remember why he's chasing Orion. That part seemed to come out of the blue.
Well, he
Not
starts out.
Orion Light Ray,
Yeah,
sorry,
I'd say,
I
yeah, the
remember.
issue starts him chasing Light Ray, yeah. As to why, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe it's just, Black Racer feels like it's his time. But apparently, if you can, like, and as opposed to reality, like, when death comes for you, when the Black Racer comes for you, if you can keep away from her, if you can get away from him and escape, you can escape death. So.
He tries to, and he gets an assist later by a character. But then
Yeah.
we cut to the scene where Orion was with all his buddies that he rescued from Apocalypse, all the humans. And he wants to get an identity to so he can look like a human, and they just give him a suitcase full of clothes and say, "Go in the closet and change." And interesting enough, he grabs his mother box and puts it against his face, and he turns ugly as hell.
He turns
Turns
to look
to look more
rather
like,
like Darkseid.
yeah, to look like he came from Apocalypse. And you get some foreshadowing that, like, he knows he's why this is my true face, right?
Yeah.
I'm gonna show my true face as Orion.
Yep. Yeah, he's using another box to look the way that he does, but yeah, the way it's not that he has this completely different appearance like I was talking about earlier with the villains and Scout, where it's like goes from like a fat bald man to you know, a huge were-owl creature. It's just like, but it, you know, Kirby draws his brow real heavy, like Darkseid's is, and it's like his eyes are real shadowed. He looks, you would think that he was a bad guy, you know, but it's mostly around his eyes that the change is cursed. But what I really liked about this scene was the woman is like totally
aroused. She's like, I want to get down on that.
She really loves Orion. It's like he's beautiful, like a sculpture by the ancient Greeks. And she makes when he comes back out dressed up in the earth clothes, he says, "See, then I am as one like yourselves." And she has to, you know, make the point to say, "Only more so, Orion." One of the guys says, "He looks like he plays pro football." So we get back to outer space or whatever you want to call it. Light Ray and the Black Racer, and the assist that you're talking about is comes from Metron. Who we think that he's on his Mobius chair, and we think that maybe he did something special to get rid of Black Racer, but he says that he just deflected his flight elsewhere and that Light Ray could have done the same thing if he had calmed down.
Yeah, he boom-tubed him back to Earth.
Boom-tube, yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's a boom-tube that he used. And so, yeah, so Black Racer ends up on Earth in a city, and comes upon a fight between a couple guys. One named Screamer, I think. And we get a connection basically to Intergang. Like one of the guys that's chasing the other guy, his name's Sugarman. He's got sunglasses. It looks like he wears his sunglasses at night, apparently.
Yeah, he's cool, too. He has a pink beret.
Yeah, a pink beret and a pink scarf.
And a pink scarf.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
He definitely has, like, the 70s.
And like, pink pants.
urban, like, blaxploitation look to him.
Yeah.
He just happens to pass by a window where a guy named Willie Walker is, he's a Vietnam hero. Sugarman seems to know him by sight. And he's basically bedridden. He's in a coma, basically. And Sugarman is about to take him out, put him out of his misery, when the Black Racer grabs the gun and smashes it and makes it explode in Sugarman's face. So then we get a interesting sequence. I didn't see this coming. I mean, I didn't know that, you know, we're going to get a change over here. So this is kind of a surprise, but basically, Willie Walker all of a sudden comes out of his coma thanks to the Black Racer, and, the Black Racer disappears into dust and his costume just lays on the floor, and Willy Walker is basically commissioned to become the new Black Racer, or at least, I don't know what, I think I got the impression that there's multiple Black Racers. I don't know if that's correct, but
I don't think so. I think he just took the role for some reason. I don't know why he would be attracted to him, but he just gave it. Now he's the Black Racer. And he seems like he's happy that he is. Like, he could walk again. He could do stuff.
Right.
But I don't think being rewarded with, oh, you get to take people to death is it's a good reward.
And he kind of, like, there's no difference in appearance. Like, it's kind of weird. I mean, you hear the name Black Racer, you think, well, and you know that he's a herald of death, and think, okay, black, dark, like evil or something like that, death. But he's black-skinned. I mean, he's African or African-American. Willie Walker's African-American. And so it's like, does that describe his skin color? And does he choose Willy Walker because he's also got dark skin? And, like, why does that matter? Like, it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I wouldn't say it's, like, racist, but it's kind of like 70s sort of doesn't have this level of sensitivity to race that we have today.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of weird. But it's a cool character. I mean, it's just one of those wild Kirby characters. And, you know, like, I don't know of anybody else that would think to have a character that's the Herald of the Death that, like, rides skis around. I mean, it's just, you know, he's the guy that created the Silver Surfer.
Yeah.
So.
And Sugar Man gets back to his inner gang home.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that he tried to kill the guy, but he couldn't kill him. And some strange entity came and destroyed his gun. And then they come in with another weapon. It's like a bomb that's like a nuclear device. It's a cool little H-bomb contraption. And Orion and the other private investigator are in their get-ups, and they crash this this place to break this up, bring mm-hmm. down the bomb.
And I love, one of my favorite things is the fact that Sugar Man, because of the explosion, has the entire top half of his, from the nose up, wrapped in bandages.
He still got shades.
But he puts his sunglasses back on. And then he drives a car, so I don't know if there's like they left slits in the bandages or something, but it looks like he's driving like blind.
Yeah.
Maybe he's got superpowers too. He's Daredevil. He's got radar sense like Daredevil.
And most of these guys seem to like not care. Like they're like drones. In other words, they're terrorists that are gonna stay back to make sure the mission's done because they want to hold off Orion while Sugar Man takes the bomb out and puts it in its destination. So they're very much like terrorists today. In other words, very goal oriented, and they'll sacrifice their lives to make sure their objective is met. But the Black Racer comes into the picture to stop Sugar Man.
Yeah, and what were they wanting to blow up with the bomb?
I thought it was a certain location they were trying to get to, but I don't remember the location.
Yeah. But it's basically the Black Racer that stopped Sugar Man.
The one guy tells him, take the bomb, planet where Apocalypse Crowd designated. So,
okay.
So they have a destination, but they don't necessarily where it is.
Yeah, I guess I think when I first read it, I assumed that it was connected to, you know, creating the chaos and stuff like that that Darkseid has been trying to accomplish with, you know, like using Mantis and Desaad and everything like that to try to. He's still trying to find the mind that contains the anti-life equation.
Yeah.
It seems like to do that, he's creating chaos and stuff, so I think probably it's connected to that.
Yeah, Black Racer touches the bomb with his ski pole, and all of a sudden the truck and the bomb get launched into space and blow up in space.
Mm-hmm.
So they thwarted the Black Racer. The Black Racer goes back to the hospital bed, and then it's interesting that Walker's sister comes into the picture, the sister and the brother-in-law, and they feel like they have to take care of Willie, even though he's in a coma. I don't think they know he's woken up, but they see him.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of goes back into his coma state. It's like that's what he remains there whenever he...
He's Willie, you know, again.
Yeah, I mean, when he gets called into commission, basically gets the power that makes him the Black Racer comes from the source, and he basically does its bidding, but when he's not needed, he goes back into his coma state as Willy Walker, and you know, his sister and her husband are his caretakers, basically, to tend to him, tend to his body and stuff like that while he's in the coma. But I love the last panel where it zooms in on his eyes, and it's like he's looks like he's staring at you, and it says, "Willie Walker's eyes grow wide. He is aware. He now knows his next quarry. Who is it? Him? Her? You?"
That's creepy.
It's like, "Oh no, he's looking at me. The black racer's coming from me.
Turn the page real quick. Turn the page.
Close the ski resort."
So that takes us into Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen 139, which has a Don Rickles cover, and Goody Rickles, which is kind of a weird name because we have Gilbert Godfrey. I was just watching a cooking show, and Gilbert Godfrey was in it, and he doesn't know how to cook, and he was just making like banana and peanut butter sandwiches and stuff.
Godfrey.
Yeah.
He used to do USA Up All Night.
Yeah.
I was like one of the hosts of that on the USA Network. They show B movies late at night.
Yeah, I remember that.
But there's some good stuff in this issue, but the Don Rickles stuff is goofy. Because that's kind of it might be my least favorite issue overall.
I think it is mine too, but there were some things I liked in this. I like the fact that they're like, before they send him back to Metropolis or let him out of this place, that they feel like they can't contaminate or spread viruses or anything that are located here locally. So they like give the Guardian a full physical before he can go back to Metropolis. And they do the same thing with the Newsboy Legion, except one of the guys has a cold. So
Gabby,
they have to,
I think.
Yeah, keep them all behind.
And the rest of them are pissed at Gabby for getting sick, and they blame it for him. And Big Word's dad comes in and interrupts the other four members of the Legion, like beating on him with rolled up newspapers.
Yeah.
So they're pissed at him.
There's not a lot to say about this issue other than Superman, Olsen, and Guardian go back home, and they end up fighting with the Rickles character, which Morgan Edge sets it up. You know.
Yeah. The Newsboy Legion does end up escaping from the project because. There's a scrapper trooper in real scrapper's hair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are, like we saw in the previous issue, that they're miniaturized versions of scrapper. But yeah, I wonder, like, did DC tell Kirby he had to put Don Rickles in it? Or, like, the reason, story-wise, is that Don Rickles is a client of Galaxy Broadcasting System, and he's, there's, like, contract negotiations or something like that, but Goody Rickles, even though they have the last name, is just a lookalike that works on staff there, and he shows up wearing, like, a superhero costume that he made, and he makes cheesy comments and jokes and stuff like that, and I imagine that it's like written to kind of sound like Don Rickles' act.
Yeah.
So Morgan Edge basically tries to send him into danger. He appeals to his ego and makes him feel like he's getting a big scoop, but he's basically trying to send him. And he does the same thing with, he sends Clark and Jimmy Olsen to the same place. And they run in the Guardian, they end up running into Goody Rickles, but you know, Morgan Edge is basically trying to get rid of all of them, and so that's why he sends them all to the same place to try to investigate this what appears to be an alien spaceship landing, basically just to try to get rid of all of them.
Yeah, it's kind of like set them in a trap and then send them away. But
Yeah.
this is an interesting too, and I think this is the first appearance of Manaheim, and
Yeah, Mannheim.
if you've read or a lot of the 80s Superman, Adventures of Superman, and all that other stuff, big inner gang part, and I think even this guy appeared in the Young Justice cartoon recently.
Oh, okay.
So he's a well-known inner gang, head of inner gang type guy, so he makes an appearance here, so that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, and I did like what he does. Like, so he sits down to dinner with the Guardian, Goody Rickles, and Jimmy Olsen, and he forces them to eat at gunpoint. So like a little confused. But as it turns out, he elates their food with something he calls pyrogranulate, and it's basically like because they ate it, it's in their bodies. He lets them go, but he can basically cause them to ignite and explode in flames whenever he wants.
Spontaneous combustion.
Yeah. So he drops them off in like a bad part of the town.
So it leaves us in that they have like 24 hours to live, and then Clark or Superman is in space. He's launched.
And it's not the last of Don Rickles, unfortunately.
Yeah, we got another issue of that coming up.
Yeah. If anybody out there knows, I'd be curious to find out if this was like how this Don Rickles appearance came about, if it was something that DC, I can't imagine Jack, I don't know, unless he was like a huge fan or something. But I'm guessing that it was just he was
Mandated.
popular at the time and mandated it, yeah.
I don't know. I wouldn't put it past the second way too, like him just being a huge Don Rickles fan and saying, "I want to bring in Don Rickles," and then him getting permission to do it.
That's true. He definitely wouldn't put, he definitely didn't have a qualm about like mixing, seemingly unrelated things.
Yeah.
This usually results in awesome, but
So, Mr. Miracle number three. So we get the first appearance of Bedlam in here.
Dr. Bedlam.
Yeah.
That's a pretty cool cover.
Yeah, I like this as, and it reminded me a little bit of the Judge Dredd movie. I don't know if you've seen it yet.
The new one?
Yeah.
No, I'm probably gonna get it on. I know it just came out on Blu-ray, so I'm probably gonna watch it next weekend.
Yeah, I like that movie. This kind of reminded me about it, even though it's not like that. But it opens up with these animates coming into a particular area, and then is Bedlam an animate, or is he just projecting himself into an animate? I think he's just projecting himself into an
Yeah.
animate on Earth. In other words, the animates come through a boof tube. One of and then one of them projects into an anim one of the animations pro has Dr. Bedlam in it, but he's still on Apocalypse.
Yeah, 'cause they say the chosen animate is now in a favorable position to await entry by the Mind Force. Stand away, the Mind Force begins to take possession of it, and then we get a page that shows the transition of it from the animates are just these like silver, nondescript. And what I thought these were interesting because it kind of reminded me, like as far as something like a theme that Kirby was experimenting with, it kind of reminded me both of like OMAC himself, but also like in OMAC the way that the peace agents or whatever they're called, where like they don't have an appearance, like they blank out their features,
Yeah.
So it kind of reminded me of the same sort of a similar theme there. But yeah, it's a cool beginning. Dr. Bedlam, he sends the rest of the animates back to Apocalypse. And
I like this scene though. I know what you're gonna say.
I freaking love Nothing can be hidden from one such as I, scot free. Your telephone number is known to me.
So he gets on the phone and makes a phone call.
He just calls him. He's like, I got your number, bitch.
He's in a death trap like usual, right? Like, and Oberon's freaking out, like, you got seconds, so you're gonna die. And then Scott's like, answer the phone.
Of all the times for the phone to ring, answer it, Oberon.
Answer it.
And it's like, what the fuck? Are you serious? He's like, he's standing there. He's got this huge cinder block up above his head. He's strapped like he's like gonna be drawn and quartered to this like wooden frame. There's like metal beams and locks all over the place, and it's just like, and he escapes, and he's like, "Damn it, Oberon, answer the phone! Why is the phone still ringing?"
Yeah. I love that scene. That was great.
Yeah. Yeah, I would love to, like, you know, Grant Morrison should write a comic where, you know, a bad guy texts.
Text somebody.
Texts a supervillain to challenge him. Because that's basically, he calls him up and, like, Scott Free recognizes Doc Bedlam from, you know, back when he was on Apocalypse. And that's basically what happens. Like, he throws down the challenge and he's like, all right, well, I got to accept. You got my phone number, so. But, yeah, I mean, poor Oberon, though, like, Scott Free, he knows about Dr. Bedlam, and he knows, like, he has, like, fear powers and stuff, so, you know, he wants to practice ahead of time, and he wants to, you know, prepare Oberon, so using the Mother Box, he kind of simulates, you know, fear, like, all these, like, crazy creatures seem to be appearing and attacking them, and, Oberon gets covered with frost while across him Scott appears to be bursting into flames like he's in the fire pits of Apocalypse, and Oberon almost passes out from fear, but and then he doesn't even take him with him.
It's like he puts him through pure hell.
He puts him through, like, he almost passes out from fright, and I guess he's just in case, like,
yeah,
Dr.
just,
Oberon gets to him or something like that.
Well, I think it's like, if Dr. Bedlam comes after you because you know me, then you're prepared.
Yeah, but the sequencing just kind of seemed kind of funny. It's like, oh, shit.
And but, this trap was cool as shit. So he arrives, and he says, well, you'll win if you get to the bottom of this building. And it looks like a trivial task because there's only a bunch of people walking, doing their business in the building.
Yeah, it's like an office building.
Yeah, just like an office building. It has like 40 floors or so, maybe 50. And he throws this pill called panic pill?
Paranoid pill.
Paranoid pill. He throws it in the ventilator system, and that just causes these people to like freak. So. Yeah. He's got to, like, go from floor 50 all the way down to the ground floor and escape going through all these people. And they're in a total frenzy.
He tries to just go out the window, like, screw this, I'll just go out the window. But Dr. Bedlam thought of that and blocked it with cosmic current.
Yeah, and each one is paranoid about something different. Like, this one woman screamed, the UFOs have landed! And then these women are fighting because of their typing. You ruined my typing!
You lie!
Yeah.
I love that panel. Yeah, you got the guy in the middle who's like, he's not so much paranoid as
frustrated.
You know, got delusions of grandeur, because he's like, I don't have to work here. I'm needed in the president's cabinet. And he's just like throwing his work on the floor.
And there's a cop just starting to shoot randomly. Take cover! Crawling with robbers!
And then you got the typical people just like, trying to kill each other in the hallways and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome.
So he tries to make his way down on his glide. the people get like a table so he can't like clear the roof. But he's able to like lay down like on these discs. So he's like laying down, but he's got his feet on one disc and his hands on the other. And he gets...
Yeah, his aero discs. Yeah, I think he used them like briefly once before. It's part of his like a his apocalypse technology that he uses from his. But yeah, eventually, I like that he runs into a mob and they think that he's a demon, and because of his costume and stuff like that, so they like lift him up and they're gonna. Conveniently, since he's an escape artist, they basically put him in an escape track. They find this big trunk in the mailroom and tie him up and throw him in there, and then like wrap lots of chains and ropes and stuff like that around it.
But they make sure he has air holes to breathe out.
That's
what I don't get. It's a demon. You want to kill a demon, but we want to keep it alive.
Yeah, although they're not too careful about it. We see the interior, and they're using this, like, wooden stake, or it's got, like, a really pointy edge on it. And it's only because he's got the mother box that he's able to predict where the sword or whatever it is going to come through and not impale him.
That's great, though. That could happen because you have different levels of paranoia, right? Well, one guy might be, well, the demon can't breathe! Gotta put his holes in! And then almost, stab.
Yeah, he's like the claustrophobe in the group. Well, you can't do that to him.
So they basically have this huge center of the building.
Yeah, like it's
just so freaking dangerous.
Huge stairwell.
Yeah, because you could just commit suicide there if you wanted. You could just jump off the area and just fall to death, and they throw the case into that thing.
Yeah, probably wouldn't be built that way in modern architecture.
But it's kind of weird because if you think about the competition, right? He needs to get to the bottom of the building, and they're kind of helping him get to the bottom of the building.
That's true.
Yeah, that's what I found ironic about this whole issue. And now that we've covered it, this is my second favorite. I like it better.
Yeah.
It's pretty
cool. And I do like that the demons, the demons, the people that think he's a demon, they essentially think by throwing him down, the middle of this stairwell that they're sending him to hell.
Yeah.
They're like, look up below. Satan is waiting to receive his own. So
we made air holes in it so it'll survive.
Yeah, they wanted the demon to live in time to be greeted by the Dark Lord Beelzebub.
I forgot how much I enjoyed the phone call, though. That was so great.
That was... I just burst out laughing.
I know Scott Free's phone number. I'm going to call.
It's almost like he's making a little, poem. Because Free and me, rhyme, so it's nothing can be hidden from one such as I, Scott Free. Your telephone number is known to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's pretty awesome. And he must, it's not like they seem to have known each other before, but it's not like, he has his old digits. He got the new digits because, Scott Free's living somewhere new now. He's Mr. Miracle, so he's keeping up with them.
Mm-hmm.
But so that wraps up this first volume. I liked we get a page of some concept drawings by Kirby that looks similar but a little bit different of Light Ray, Orion, Mantis, Mr. Miracle, Darkseid, and Metron. And then there's the volume has, like I said earlier, an afterword by Mark Evanier that's, kind of interesting.
Were there any, highlights in there that you want to mention? Because I didn't read the afterword.
Well, I kind of skimmed it. I did mention, I thought it was interesting that, the Black Racer wasn't really. But it gives kind of a background of where Kirby was at, why he went to D.C., that even in the 70s and stuff, the early 70s, he had come off of working for Marvel in the 60s and being so fundamental to all the characters that we created that still is basically, Marvel's cash cow today. and how he was increasingly frustrated that, you know, he was promised a lot of stuff, and then the owner of Marvel sold the company, who wasn't aware of any of those promises. So, you know, they pretty much, like a lot of other people who have come to mistakenly think, the new owners of Marvel even thought that Stan Lee was basically the main reason that they had all those characters. So, you know, he talks about him going over to DC and his plans for the Fourth World. And one thing I did want to note, because we talked about it earlier, wondering why he ended up, you know, in addition to creating three new titles, why he ended up doing Jimmy Olsen. And he does talk about that here. The number crunch. So they agreed on a salary that was rumored to be the richest ever for a person who wrote or drew comics. It wasn't really. They paid him the same per page that they were paying their top artists, and gave him a small editorial fee. The reason it seemed large was because he was contractually producing a minimum of 15 pages per week.
Jesus.
And it was insane. And Jack wanted the 15 to be new books, new kinds of comics, and essentially what he did with the other three titles. But DC and their budgeters, they said that he'd need to do one issue a month of a book already on their schedule. And Kirby wasn't real happy about that. He was more interested in innovating and coming up with new ideas. You know, the Kirby tradition is to create a new comic, he said. And so basically the reason he took on Superman's Pale was because he reportedly said to Carmine Infantino, "Give me your worst-selling book and I'll make it your best-selling book." And Evanier says that Jack would say things like that sometimes, so it's possible. But really the real reason that he got Jimmy Olsen, because it wasn't actually their worst-selling book, was because it wasn't currently assigned to anybody. That it was in the midst of a creative team change, so that's why he ended up getting it. But Kirby just ended up, you know, so he compromised. He took on Jimmy Olsen, but he started putting all of his Fourth World ideas in there. And that also explains why, you know, we get more issues of, you know, Jimmy Olsen than of the others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that was part of his contract that he had to put one issue of that out a month. So that's
the one he probably felt forced to do.
Yeah, somewhat.
But he took control of it and did his own thing in it anyway.
Yeah, he basically said, you know, he put so much new stuff in the issue, despite the fact that it was an established title, given a peek at Darkseid for the first time, and building up the story with the factory and Simeon and Mokari and stuff. And then, you know, there was actually, you know, so you had a few issues of those come out. For people reading at the time, you'd had several months of those. And then you really got to see the beginnings of the Fourth World when Forever People number one came out, followed by New Gods number one.
Mm-hmm.
So, pretty neat. And I was like, you know, because it's like that circumstances like that influence the final product, you know.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, we're aware of those things when we pick up our new comics off the shelf right now. We might know, you know, just a random example off the top of my head. I mean, we know right now when we get like two issues of Batgirl not written by Gail Simone, we know, you know, she was briefly fired from the title and then hired back. But 30 years from now, someone picks up like 25 issues of Batgirl off, you know, eBay or whatever exists, then
they're not going to know.
They'll have to do their research because they won't just automatically know, you know.
They'll just say, what are these fill-in issues by that other team?
Yeah, and that happens all the time. It's a natural assumption to make, but
yeah,
and then they might look into it and find out there's more to it. So, yeah, it's kind of it's always neat to kind of understand the circumstances because sometimes that, you know, influences what was created, you know.
Right.
So.
All right, so I guess we'll start the next volume. Are we going to still do 3 issues, or do you want to lower it, or what do you want to do?
3 still works for me.
Okay, we'll still
I mean,
do
I'm flexible,
three.
But that works for me. I got them all on the shelf here, so.
Okay. That works.
Good stuff.
All right, so this has been episode 6. Is it 6 or 5? 6?
6, yep.
6. And this is Geek Brunch Retrocast with Mike and Chris, and you can reach us at the Geek Brunch podcast site. And on Twitter, it's at MythMakingETC or at Mike Myers Brunch. And leave us feedback either on – I think you can leave comments now. I fixed that. Either on the Geek Brunch site or on our forums at Forum for Geeks. Scroll down to Geek Brunch. We'll have an episode thread.
Yep.
I'm doing an interesting experiment on that thread where I'm tracking every movie I watch and every comic I read. So it'll have everything that I read for every, you know, as the week goes on. And so far, that's working out. That's pretty cool to track, even statistically, to see how much I read per week. It could have other metrics that come out of it. Like,
yes.
What do I need to... I'm buying way too much, that kind of thing, if I can only read this much.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a way that I've cut back at times is... made a list of all the comics I'm buying, like all the ongoings at least, and then ordered them in preference and then, you know, trimmed from the bottom, you know.
Yeah. You can also go to Facebook and search for Geek Brunch Podcast and then click the like button and follow us there. We always have photos of all the books that we cover, and then we have a episode thread there. And sometimes we post pics of things that we've talked about, like we might have a commercial of some toy we talked about or something like that in there.
Or Superman masturbating.
Yeah, or Superman masturbating. I'll post that because I posted that on my regular Facebook wall, but since it's part of the episode, I'll throw it in there. And my editor said I spelled masturbate wrong, so...
Oh, was that Mr. Knudsen? Or?
No, my wife. She edits.
Ah.
Because I usually type it on my phone. I misspell. I'm terrible, and she's always editing them. She's like,
yeah,
did
I
you
like
know
that.
What you just said? You're speaking like a caveman here.
Yeah, I like that Barb is a grammar Nazi because I you know, I have the English background too, and she'll always post. You know, she posts stuff on Facebook about, like, using the correct twos, you know, two, two, and two, and there and there, and stuff like that. And
she's my editor. She's looking at that. Except it's usually too late.
Right.
What I really need to do is go through the editor before I post.
Yeah.
I don't have the time for that kind of nonsense. But, what else did I mention everything?
I think so, yeah. You know, between like geekbrunchpodcast.com, you can also check out the regular Geek Brunch. Though I assume anybody listening to this is aware of the fact that there's a regular Geek Brunch show. If there's somebody out there that wasn't, like, write us in because you're probably the only one. But regular Geek Brunch is a good place. You guys... I would say, I mean, you guys cover a lot of indie stuff, so if you're looking for a place with discussion of current indie comics and, you know, movies and TV and stuff like that, you know, the forums would be a good place to talk about that stuff too, or Facebook.
Yeah, Geek Brunch is like the free for all. We could talk about anything. So,
yeah, you guys last episode talked about food for like the last half hour at least.
Right.
So.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks then, Chris.
All right. Sounds good. Yeah. Talk to you, Mike, and talk to everybody out there.
Yeah. Leave us feedback. Let us know what you think, like Steve did.
Yeah.
And next episode, we'll try to get Steve to talk some cartoons. Maybe we could do that.
Yeah, that's a great idea. He mentioned the cartoon thing to me too, and that brought me back. That's a good idea because, you know, back in the day, you know, Saturday morning was awesome for cartoons, and you know, I used to wait and see, you know, what the lineup was going to be, just like you do with like the fall, you know, TV lineup. Like, what are the new cartoons this year, and what time are they going to be on? Am I going to watch at 9 o'clock? Am I going to watch ABC or CBS? Like, oh shit, there's two cartoons on at the same time. Which one do I like more? Because VCRs don't exist.
Right.
You know, so yeah.
All right.
Cool.
We'll have to do that.
All right, sounds good.
All right, talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Check.